All right, hour three of the WGN Radio Theater. And in this hour, Lucille Ball and Richard Denning are Liz and George Cooper on My Favorite Husband in an April Fool's Day broadcast. You won't want to miss that. Then it's part three of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, with the Lamar Matter from 1956, starring Bob Bailey. Right, Lisa?
Right. If you say it, Carl, it must be true.
It's all queued up, ready to go. But first, these words. Welcome back. I'm Carl Amari. This is the WGN Radio Theater. My co-host Lisa Wolf is right there. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Not too close, but I'm right here.
Yeah. A little social distancing here. We are here each and every Saturday night from 10 p.m. until 3 o'clock in the morning, five full hours of your favorite classic radio shows. Make sure you tell a friend that we're on the air right here on WGN, bringing you all your favorites. And in this hour, we will tune into My Favorite Husband, but I want to remind you that there are five free classic radio shows waiting for you at 100radioshows.com. That's our website. When you go there, just put your email in, and we'll instantly send you five free classic radio shows. You'll have Suspense, Jack Benny, Fibber McGee and Molly, Gunsmoke, and Richard Diamond, Private Detective, right, Lisa?
I was just going to say it for you, but you're on it, Carl.
Yeah, you'll get five shows absolutely free, and there are also hundreds of other classic radio shows there for purchase. If you want to buy any of those, make sure you use the promo code RADIO at checkout, because you will save a whopping 70% off your order. That's our way of thanking you for listening to this show. Go to 100radioshows.com. All right, My Favorite Husband, situation comedy series, premiered on radio in 1948. Lucille Ball and Richard Denning starred as Liz and George Cooper, a married couple billed as two people who live together and like it. It was sponsored by J-E-L-L-O. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Jell-O was the sponsor. I think I was off key.
I think. It must have been you.
I was off key.
I'm pretty sure.
George was a banker and Liz was his happily married housewife. Gail Gordon was George's boss, Rudolph Atterbury, and B. Benaderet was Atterbury's wife. And Ball refused to transition this show to television without her husband,
Desi, sure.
Arnaz. And so they later reworked the concept into I Love Lucy. And you know what happened when they did that?
Oh, boy, do I.
It became one of the most successful television shows in history. But right now, it's time for My Favorite Husband from April 1st, 1949, an April Fool's show. Lucille Ball stars. Here is My Favorite Husband.
It's time for My Favorite Husband, starring Lucille Ball.
Jell-O, everybody.
Yes, it's the new gay family series starring Lucille Ball with Richard Denning. Brought to you by the Jell-O family of desserts.
J-E-L-L-O. The big red letters stand for the Jell-O family. Oh, the big red letters stand for the Jell-O family. That's Jell-O.
Yum, yum, yum.
Jell-O pudding.
Yum, yum, yum.
Jell-O tapioca pudding. Yes, sirree.
And now Lucille Ball with Richard Denning as Liz and George Cooper, two people who live together and like it.
As we look in on the Coopers tonight, George hasn't returned home from work, and Liz is in the kitchen talking to Katie, the maid.
Do you know what day this is, Katie?
Yes, Mrs. Cooper, it's Friday.
Yes, but it's also April Fool's Day, and I just thought I'd warn you that I put an exploding cigarette in that package in the living room.
Well, why warn me? Do you think I snitch cigarettes out of your living room?
Oh, why, no, Katie, but I noticed that you're smoking, and I just didn't want
to... I might not make much here, Mrs. Cooper, but I can still buy my own cigarettes. I don't stoop to petty things like stealing them.
I'm sorry, Katie. It's just that you have a cigarette in your mouth, and I wanted to be sure you didn't get the exploding one.
I accept your apology. Well, never mind the laughing, Mrs. Cooper. Help me find my upper plate.
Oh, there's one joke gone bluey. Well, this trick won't miss. Mm-hmm.
Well, what are you doing, Mrs. Cooper? Mm-hmm. Kissing the handkerchief?
Yeah, I want to smear it all up good with lipstick and slip it in George's pocket.
I don't get it.
Don't you see? I'll make some excuse and get him to take out his handkerchief, and then I'll just step back and let him try to explain the lipstick on it.
Oh, Mrs. Cooper, that's an awful thing to do to anybody.
Yeah, it's a dirty, sneaky thing to do, and I'm glad I thought of it.
But how are you going to plant it on him?
You're going to help me. Now, when he comes in, I'll stop him in the hall, and you reach out through the kitchen door and put the handkerchief in his overcoat pocket.
Oh, I feel like one of those, what do they call pickpockets? A regular drip.
Oh. That's dip. Now, get ready, Katie. He'll be home any minute. Here's the handkerchief.
Here you are, Mr. Anderson. A chocolate malt. Oh, hi, Mr. Cooper.
Hello, Felix. How's the drugstore business tonight?
Oh, business is fine, Mr. Cooper. Everybody's sick. What can I do for you?
Well, I want to play an April Fool joke on my wife, and I was wondering if you sell any of those novelty gags?
Like a glass of dribbles, or itching powder, or candy with soap in it?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. We don't have any.
Oh, that's too bad.
Hey, why don't you try Miller's? They got some swell-loaded cigars.
Well, that'd be fine, Felix, but Liz gave up cigars for Lent.
Oh. Well, you might try the trick I played on my fiancée, Imogene. We're engaged.
I gather that.
Yeah. Anyway, I told her I'd lost my job and didn't have any money. Just as a joke.
Did she fall for it?
Yeah, I think so. She gave me my ring back.
You know, that's a good idea, Felix. I'll tell Liz I lost my job at the bank.
Yeah. Do you think she'll give you your ring back?
No, that's too much to hope for. But it'll be a lot of fun.
Well, here comes George now, Katie. Don't forget the handkerchief.
That you, George?
Yes, dear. It's me. I'm home.
Why, George, what's the matter? You look sick. Are you ill?
No, Liz,
You got hit by a car.
No, honey.
You were robbed.
No, darling.
You've been poisoned?
No,
Well, don't just stand there like a lump of putty. Tell me what happened.
Liz, I lost my job.
Oh, is that all?
Is that all?
Oh, George, what's a job as long as it isn't your health? If you'd broken your leg or something, it would be... You lost your job! Oh, why couldn't you just have broken your leg? How did it happen?
They fired me, Liz. I've foreclosed my last widow. They're already scraping my name off the door.
I can't believe it.
Yes, when I left, it was already down to George Coop.
But, George, you've been with the bank 10 years.
I know. Everybody felt terrible about it. There wasn't a dry eye in the place.
Well, I should hope not.
It even caused a run on the bank.
It did?
Yes. They were all crying so hard, people thought the bank had failed.
But why, George? Why did they fire you?
Well, the bank examiner discovered I'd done something wrong.
George, you don't mean that you...
Yes, Liz, I put new points in the bank pens.
What?
April Fool!
You mean you didn't lose your job?
Oh, of course not. Boy, did you fall for that.
George Cooper, that was a dirty trick.
Well, you're not mad, are you, Liz? I sort of half expected you to play an April Fool's trick on me.
Me? I wouldn't stoop to such a low trick.
Mrs. Cooper, can I see you a minute?
I'll be right there, Katie. George, give me your handkerchief a minute, will you?
Well, wait till I take my overcoat off.
No, don't take your coat off yet.
Well, why not? It's warm in here.
Oh, well, then why don't you take out your handkerchief and mop your brow?
Liz, do you feel well?
I feel fine. Matter of fact, I feel like playing a game.
What game?
Drop the handkerchief.
I think you've blown your top, Liz.
George, kiss me.
Yeah, do you mind if I take my coat off first?
No, kiss me right now.
Liz, if you're driving at something, I want to... Phew, now I've got to take my coat off.
Oh, look, I got lipstick on you. Give me your handkerchief, darling.
No, oh, never mind. I'll take it off with the Kleenex.
Oh, give me your handkerchief. There's one sticking out of your coat pocket.
Well, that's funny. I never carry a handkerchief there.
Let's have it.
I don't know how this got in my... Uh-oh, oh, that's not a handkerchief.
Let me see it.
It's not a handkerchief.
What is it?
My shirt tail. I have a hole in my pocket.
If it's your shirt tail, how can you hold it behind your back like that?
It isn't easy.
Let me see that, George. Why, it is a handkerchief. And it's got lipstick on it.
No, it hasn't, Liz. Honest, that's not lipstick.
Then what is it?
Well, the truth is, I had a nosebleed today.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, that's it. I had a nosebleed.
Your blood type seems to be Tangy.
Well, Liz, I might as well tell you the truth.
Don't strain yourself.
Mrs. Cooper, come here a minute, will you?
Just a minute, Katie. Well, George, have you thought of a good truth yet?
Yes. I mean, this is the way it happened. You know Miss Johnson, that homely old maid secretary down at the bank.
Yes.
Well, I accidentally bumped into her, and some of her lipstick got on my cheek.
She doesn't even come up to your shoulder. What was she doing, walking on stilts?
Well, no.
You don't really expect me to believe that, do you?
All right. I'll tell you the truth. I haven't the slightest idea where that lipstick came from. You think what you want to. I don't care to discuss it anymore. What are you laughing at?
April Fool!
What are you talking about?
That's my lipstick. I put some of it on your handkerchief and I planted it on you.
Well, you didn't fool me. I knew it all the time.
Oh, sure. Oh, George, you are so funny.
Now we're even.
Oh, husbands are so silly. They have such guilty consciences. Don't you know I'd trust you, George, no matter how bad things looked?
Oh, thank you, darling.
Mrs. Cooper.
Oh, I forgot. Coming, Katie. I'll be right back, darling. What do you want, Katie?
It's about your April Fool joke, Mrs. Cooper.
Oh, it worked beautifully. You should have seen George's face.
You mean you've already done it?
Yes, why?
Well, how could you? I didn't put the hand... Katie!
What are you trying to tell me?
Well, he didn't stand close enough to the door. I couldn't slip the handkerchief in his pocket.
Oh, no, Katie.
I've still got it. Here it is.
What are you doing, honey? Come on into the living room and talk to me, baby.
Don't baby me, you monster! All right, George, how did the lipstick get on that other handkerchief?
I don't know. I thought you said you trusted me, Liz.
I did, and look what happened.
I thought it was a scream when I had one handkerchief with lipstick on it. Two of them ought to give you a real laugh.
You should be ashamed of yourself, George Cooper.
Look, Liz, I've been framed.
Ha!
Liz, outside of this house, I don't know what a kiss is.
Scientists don't know what electricity is either, but they know how to use it.
Oh, stop. I thought you were the one who wasn't jealous.
I'm not. I merely have a healthy curiosity.
Well, for the last time, I don't know where that lipstick came from.
Ha!
Now, look, Liz, I'm getting fed up. Do you believe me or not?
All right, George.
All right.
I believe you.
And that's the last time we'll hear of it.
Yes, George.
Good. Now, let's go to bed.
All right. George?
What?
Who was she?
George. George, wake up.
Hmm? What's the matter?
Was it the blonde cashier at the bank?
Oh, Liz, this is the third time you've waked me up. Now cut it out.
Was it Anita Aaron? Elaine Abbott? Dora Allberg? The A1 Cleaning Company? No, couldn't be them.
Where are you getting those names?
Out of the phone book. Now I'm going to find out who it was if I have to go through the whole book.
I'll go to sleep.
All right, Cooper, start talking.
What are you doing, Liz? Don't shine that bright light in my face.
This is the third degree. Now start talking. Who was it?
Now stop it, Liz. You've been pestering me all night. Now will you please let me get some sleep?
Well, all right, George. I won't ask you any more tonight.
Thank you. Good night. Oh, no, that isn't the alarm, is it?
Yes, and now that it's morning, George, who was it?
Oh.
Well, seems like everything happens to the Coopers, and that's not just cricket, is it? But say, here's something swell that can happen to your family. You can start right now treating them to delicious Jell-O puddings. Jell-O chocolate, butterscotch, and vanilla pudding. Boy, take it from me, there's something rich and distinctive, smooth as cream, chock full of old-fashioned homemade goodness. Try luscious Jell-O chocolate pudding in this tempting chocolate roll. Just prepare your pudding as directed on the package, reducing the milk to 1 3/4 cups. Cool, spread on a sheet of sponge cake, and roll it up like a jelly roll. It's a grand and glorious dessert treat. Jell-O puddings is so quick and easy to prepare. All you do is add milk, and they take about 5 minutes to cook. Get all three Jell-O puddings tomorrow, and find out why more women buy Jell-O puddings than any other prepared puddings in the world.
J-E-L-L-O.
Hey, George. George, wake up.
I tell you, I don't know where the lipstick came from.
What are you talking about, George? You went to sleep right at your desk.
Huh? Oh, hi, George. I didn't get any sleep last night. Liz found a handkerchief in my pocket with lipstick on it.
Oh, George, you sly devil, you.
I have no idea where it came from.
Hey, George, this is Joe, not Liz.
I'm telling you the truth.
Oh, it's a shame.
Shame?
Yeah. As long as you got arrested, it's too bad you didn't get to enjoy the crime.
Very funny.
Oh, don't worry, George. Uncle Joe's got a great idea. I'll call Liz and tell her I planted the handkerchief on you for an April Fool's joke.
Hey, now you're talking sense.
And it's all settled. I'll call right after you get home tonight, and the minute she hangs up, she'll fall into your arms.
Good.
Oh, say, I almost forgot what I came in here for. Atterbury wants to see you in his office.
Yeah, all right. Don't forget to call tonight.
I won't.
Did you send for me, Mr. Atterbury?
Yes. Come in, George boy. Understand you had a little trouble at home last night.
Well, yes, but how'd you hear about it?
Well, things get around. Oh, you devil, you.
Oh, not you, too. I have no idea who put that lipstick on my handkerchief.
Of course not. Who was she, boy?
Listen, I said I don't know. But if I find the moron who put that handkerchief in my pocket, I'll punch him right in the nose.
Oh, I don't think you would.
Not much I wouldn't.
Well, here's my nose. Start punching.
Are you the moron? I mean, did you do it?
April Fool! Oh, it worked better than I thought.
Well, I should say it did. Liz is furious with me.
Yeah, no.
She kept me up all night quizzing.
Yeah.
Well, frankly, Mr. Atterbury, I don't think it was funny. If you want to see me on business, I'll be in my office.
Oh,
goodbye.
Don't go away, mad boy. Oh, that poor guy. I'll do something to straighten it out for him.
Mrs. Cooper, you can't stay out here in the kitchen all night.
I'm very happy reading this book. I don't care to sit in the same room with you-know-who until he explains how that you-know-what got into his you-know-where.
You mean you're going to stay here until what's-his-name explains about whatchamacallit?
Yes. And don't worry about me. I'm not the least bit upset. And I'm enjoying this book.
Do you always hold the book upside down when you read it?
What? Oh, well, I wish I did know where that hanky came from. I'll get it. Hello.
Hello, Liz. This is Joe Ridgely.
Oh, hello, Joe. Do you want to speak to George?
Hey, well, gosh, I don't know if I dare. I hope I haven't caused him any trouble.
What do you mean?
Well, yesterday was April Fool's, and I put a handkerchief in his pocket with a lot of lipstick on it.
You did?
Yeah. And then I forgot to go ahead with the trick, and he went home before I remembered. You weren't mad, were you?
Me? Mad? Oh, Joe.
Well, some women would have blown their tops.
Joe, what kind of a wife do you think I am? I did see it, and George said he didn't know where it came from, and that was the end of it.
Yeah?
Sure.
Well, I just thought I'd call in case anything went wrong.
Well, thanks for calling, Joe. George?
Yes, Liz?
That was Joe Ridgely on the phone.
Oh, now do you believe I didn't know where that handkerchief came from?
How did you know what he told me?
I was listening to your end of the conversation, and I put two and two together.
Oh. Well, George, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's all right, Liz. I understand.
I guess I was just a mean, jealous, nagging wife.
Yes, you were.
Well, you don't have to agree with me.
Oh, now, honey, now, don't start crying.
Do you forgive me?
Well, I guess so.
Kiss me, George. I promise never to be jealous again. Scout's honor.
Honey, you just don't appreciate me. I'm as trustworthy and loyal as an old dog.
George?
What?
Let me sit on your lap, dog. Oh, darn it, I'll get it. Hello?
Hello, is that you, Liz, girl?
Oh, hello, Mr. Atterbury, how are you?
Fine, girl, fine. But I have some explaining to do to you.
To me?
Yes, about a little April Fool joke I played on George.
Oh, you too. I just heard about another one that was played on him. What did you do?
I slipped a handkerchief with lipstick on it in George's pocket. Liz? Are you there?
I'm here, all right. Didn't you notice anything unusual when you put the handkerchief in George's pocket?
Like what?
Like finding you were shaking hands with Joe Ridgely?
I don't know what you mean. I just wanted to be sure you understood, Liz.
Oh, I understand perfectly.
Oh, then everything's all right.
Everything is just ginger peachy.
Good. Well, goodbye, girl.
Goodbye, boy.
What was it, Liz?
You're back in the doghouse, Rover.
What's the matter?
Another entry has just come in the George Cooper Alibi Derby.
What?
Joe Ridgely said he put the handkerchief in your pocket. Now Mr. Atterbury comes up with the same story. Which story do you want me to believe?
Well, now, Liz...
Which friend has the phony?
Liz, I can explain. Mr. Atterbury was telling the truth, and Joe was just doing me a favor. You're being jealous again.
You're darn right I am.
Well, what about that scout's honor?
Shake hands with an ex-brownie.
Liz, I've told you the truth. If you don't believe me, I'll treat you like the child that you are and put you over my knee.
You wouldn't dare.
Oh, wouldn't I? Come on,
put
over
me
my
down.
Knee.
I won't let you. Oh.
Now, you're just crying because I hurt your pride.
And that isn't all. Gee, that hurt. I never got spanked that much when I was little.
Well, when you were little, there wasn't that much to spank.
First you smooch other women, then you beat me, and now you say I'm a big fat cow.
I didn't for a big fat cow.
See, you admit it. Well, George, if that's the way you're going to act, there isn't room for both of us under this roof. I'm leaving. George, I said I'm leaving.
Goodbye.
Now, don't you try and stop me.
Who's stopping you?
I'm going to leave right now. Well, I'm leaving.
Okay, okay.
I really am leaving.
Goodbye.
For the last time, I'm leaving.
I said goodbye.
Goodbye. Next time, I'm going out the door.
Go ahead.
Oh, you heartless beast. Just for that, I'm leaving. Goodbye. Go
ahead. Give me another one. And this time, make it a double. I'm going to drown my sorrows.
But, Mrs. Cooper, that's your third lemon Coke.
I know, Felix. I don't care what happens to me. Felix, men are beasts.
Yeah, I guess we are.
And George Cooper's the biggest beast of all.
Well, I always thought he was a great guy.
To you, yes. But to me, he's cruel and nasty.
Gee whiz.
And I've left him forever.
Gee whiz.
Do you know what he did, Felix? He beat me.
Gee whiz.
I had a feeling you'd say that.
Liz, there you are. Gee whiz, I've been looking all over for you.
Don't speak to her, you cad.
What? Liz, I didn't think you were serious about leaving. Come on home.
Felix, will you tell Mr. Cooper I'm not speaking to him?
She's not speaking to you.
Oh, look, Liz.
Through me, please.
Well, tell her I apologize, and I'd like her to come home with me.
He apologizes, and he'd like you to come home with him.
I'm not going home to a wife beater.
She's not going home to a wife beater.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
Tell Mr. Cooper he's wasting his time.
You're wasting your time.
I am not.
He is not.
I refuse to continue this exchange of banalities, and I will consider it a favor if he will remove his person from this vicinity.
I refuse to... You care for a malt, Mr. Cooper?
Now, Liz, cut out this nonsense.
Now, Liz, cut out this nonsense.
You keep out of this, Felix.
You keep out of this, Felix. Oh.
Mr. Cooper, that I...
Why, George Cooper, how are you?
Hello, Charlie.
Say, I'm glad I ran into you. I've got your overcoat.
What?
Yeah, I picked it up by mistake at lunch yesterday. You must have mine. Here's yours.
Oh, thanks.
Let me see that. Well, George, it is your coat.
I hope you didn't look in the pockets of my coat. I had a heavy date the night before.
George, if this is true, what about those other stories, Mr. Atterbury's and Ridgely's?
Oh, they were just friends trying to help me out.
Oh, George, I'm awfully sorry.
Well, you should be. I'll bring your coat down to the bank tomorrow, Charlie.
Oh, all right, George. Oh, give me a Coke, son.
George, will you take me with you, please?
Well... All right.
Oh, thanks, George. You're so wonderful.
Gee whiz. I'm sure glad they made up. They're swell people, aren't they?
I don't know. I never saw them before.
Yeah.
Well, how come you had his coat? Search me. He stopped me on the street outside, handed me the coat, gave me $10 to come in and say that.
Yes, Lucille.
Well, so long, Robert. I'm off on another session of Making the Most Out of Radio.
What are you going to do?
I'm going to see the world, find out what's going on. Let's see now. Alaska, the Bering Straits, the land of the midnight sun. Mm-hmm. Sounds like fun. That's it. Mr. Soundman, on to the Arctic Ocean. I said on to it, not into it. What's the matter? Couldn't you get your bearings straight? Well, Alaska looks pretty good.
Bum, 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 bee-boo.
Well, here comes a great big white bear, and it's singing. Pardon me, what kind of a bear are you?
I'm a polar.
I had to pick up an Alaskan cornball. Say, how come you can talk, Bear Boy?
Well, if I couldn't, how could I say the Jell-O puddings are a trio of treats?
Well, you know, you have a very important point there. What else is brewing along the same line? Brewing, get it?
Well, Jell-O chocolate pudding is luscious with deep-down chocolatey goodness.
Well, I'll bear you out on that. I'm sorry, go ahead, I won't say another word.
Jell-O butterscotch pudding has that buttery brown sugar flavor. Jell-O vanilla pudding is rich and smooth as cream. Jell-O puddings are so easy to make, too. All you do is add milk, and they take only about 5 minutes to cook to a velvety, rich perfection.
Thank you. You have just heard a program from Alaska where the nights are 6 months long. Tune in again tomorrow night at 11:30 November and hear our little comedy of Eskimo family life, The Icebergs. Good night, all.
You have been listening to My Favorite Husband, starring Lucille Ball with Richard Denning, and based on characters created by Isabel Scott Laurie. Lucille Ball will soon be seen in the Columbia picture Miss Grant Takes Richmond. Be sure to listen to Lucille Ball and My Favorite Husband again next week, presented by...
J-E-L-L-O. The big red letters stand for the Jell-O family. Oh, the big red letters stand for the Jell-O family. That's Jell-O.
Yum, yum, yum.
Jell-O pudding.
Yum, yum, yum.
Jell-O tapioca puddings. Yes, sirree.
Bob Lamond speaking. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
And that's My Favorite Husband, an April Fool's show from April 1st, 1949, starring Lucille Ball and Richard Denning. And I hope you enjoyed that.
Did
you
like it? I was going to
love it, right?
I love Lucille Ball. Gosh, also, you should check out our Facebook page. I have a fun fact up there about Lucille Ball and her production company, Desilu Productions.
That's right.
And
check that out.
And a beautiful picture of Lucille Ball.
She was so glamorous,
it's
right?
Just, she's breathtaking in that photo.
Yeah, just beautiful, right? All right. Well, are you ready for part three of this Yours Truly Johnny Dollar
program? Yeah, let's do it.
We've been listening to this. Now, each hour we're playing a quarter hour episode of the Lamar Matter. It was a five-part story. Let's go back to March 28th, 1956. This is part three. Here's Yours Truly Johnny Dollar.
From Hollywood, it's time now for...
Johnny Dollar.
Johnny, this is Vonnie.
Oh, yes?
Please, come out here to the house, right away.
Is something wrong?
Johnny, you said you came back here to South Bend to... Well, because you didn't want me to have to be alone to face the death of my father.
Yes, dear, I...
Johnny, you also said you have business here.
Well, yes.
Is it connected with my father's death?
Vonnie...
Please, dear, don't lie to me. He was insured for over $1 million. Or do you know that?
I... Listen...
Was this business of yours connected with Daddy? Was it because you, too, think he was murdered? Johnny?
I'll come out and see you.
Tonight and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account, America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator...
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to the Home Office, Universal Adjustment Bureau, Hartford, Connecticut. Assignment, the Lamar matter. The question, was it murder? The beautiful girl, Vonnie Lamar, and the beautiful romance I found during my so-called vacation at La Jolla, California. Well, things really got into a bind when she received news that her foster father back in South Bend, Indiana, had suddenly died. And I received word that I was assigned to the case, not only because of the $1.5 million policy on Lamar's life, but because it looked as though it might be nothing more nor less than murder. From La Jolla, California to South Bend, Indiana was only a quick flight by plane, and the first person I contacted was Lawrence Comstock of Tri-Mutual, Chicago office, who'd issued the policies on Lamar's life.
Yes, Johnny, the only two real friends Thomas Lamar had these past few years since his wife died were Dr. Ed Wilson and myself.
And Wilson is the man you called in when Lamar died.
Yes, you see, Tom and I used to spend a lot of time together. Weekend golf, belong to the same clubs, that sort of thing. We used to love playing two-handed pinochle together.
Uh-huh. Go on.
I was with him at his house the night he died. And so unexpectedly, Johnny, as I told you, he'd had a most thorough physical examination only a few months before, or I'd never have permitted him to increase his insurance to $1.5 million.
Must have cost him a fancy premium.
It did. It did. Prohibitive. But that was the way he wanted it. For his adopted daughter. For Vani. Whom you know. And if you're half a man, having spent a few days with her in La Jolla, you're in love.
Oh, shut up and tell me what you know, will you? You said murder.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry, Johnny. It began last weekend. As I often do, I spent the weekend with Tom, Thomas Lamar. Well, Friday night, Dr. Ed Wilson was with us. We played three-handed pinochle.
Yes, yes.
Tom was in perfect health. I know he was. And our evening was all fun, completely uninterrupted. Except by young Marson.
Marson?
Tom's confidential secretary. And he's the one.
Larry, you are the one who told Pat McCracken back in Hartford that you thought Thomas Lamar was murdered. That's why you wanted me to come on out here to investigate the case.
Yes.
Why not tell me the truth? Is it because of your great friendship for Lamar? Because of the $1.5 million policy through your company? Or because you really think he was murdered?
Are you here because of the commission you can earn on a case as big as this? Or because Thomas Lamar happened to be the father of Vani Lamar?
I was ordered on this case from Hartford.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, of course.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Now, maybe I'm a silly old fuddy-duddy. Maybe I'm more worked up over this case than you are. Whatever the reason. But let me tell you this thing in my own way.
Go on, Larry.
Well, we know, Ed Wilson and I because of being so close to Tom Lamar so long, Ed because of his medical knowledge, we know that Tom was in perfect health. His 59 years were nothing for a specimen like him. Ed left Friday night. I stayed on. Saturday, we played 9 holes of golf. Tom wanted to play 18, but I didn't feel up to it. And that night, we played pinochle. Just the two of us. And we got to bed early. Well, Sunday, we just sat around and talked until evening when we played cards again. There was no strain, Johnny, even if the man had had a bad heart or something.
I understand. Now, what about this Marson you named?
We quit shortly before midnight. I was tired, my years, no doubt. And I knew Tom would have a hard day at the plant on Monday. And so I suggested we get to bed. He smiled, as only Tom could smile. A warm, tolerant, yet at the same time understanding and friendly, completely friendly smile.
Go on, go on.
And he said he'd probably have to take one of Ed Wilson's sleeping pills to doze off so early. But I knew, Johnny.
You knew what?
Sugar pills. That's all Ed had ever given him. Sugar pills. I think Tom knew it, too.
Well?
I went up to my room, Tom to his. I heard the water running in his bathroom. About the same time I was brushing my teeth. And then the crash.
Crash?
Yes. I ran out through the hall to his room. He was lying on the floor of the bath, broken tumbler beside him. He left the bottle of sugar pills still open.
He'd taken one of them?
Yes. And he was dead.
You mean you
no,
think...
No, no, I called Ed Wilson. He was there in only minutes. It was he who officially said that Tom was dead. Had died instantaneously. And he was sure it was poison. Peculiar color of the lips or something.
What do you mean?
Some terrible stimulant to the heart. A very rare drug that only a few researchers would know about. Even the heart of a young and healthy boy would find the influence of this drug too much, too strong.
Dr. Wilson told you this?
Yes.
What is this drug?
I don't know. Something very rare. But he is sure that's what did it.
Well, what did the police say? You called them in, didn't you?
Ed did. They'd never heard of it either, the drug. But they've sent samples of the sugar pills to Chicago and to Washington for analysis.
Well?
We should hear from them shortly.
Where is this Dr. Ed Wilson?
Oh, here. I'll just write you his address.
Good, thanks. All right now, Larry.
Yes?
You told me earlier there was one man you thought might be responsible for this. Who?
Walter Marson.
Who's Walter Marson?
Walter has been Thomas Lamar's personal private secretary for some years.
Go on.
And Walter has been married to Levon for over a year. Oh, I'm sorry, Johnny, because I know how you feel about her.
Well, why should that make him want to murder Vonnie's father?
Because of Thomas's will. Tom made a will, Johnny, that left virtually everything he owned to the corporation of which he was the head, except for his life insurance.
Is that why the amount of his insurance was so big?
I suppose so. The sole beneficiary of the policy, as you know, is Vonnie.
Well, go on. Go
Therefore,
on.
The only way in which anyone else could share in the estate is by being married to her.
All right. You've knocked down a couple of dream castles for me. And I'm not talking about a family fortune. I'm talking about a girl.
Yes, John, I understand.
If she loved him enough to marry him, let him be happy. If he shares some of that $1.5 million, well, let him share it. He deserves to, if she wants him to. He married her, she married him, all right.
It isn't as easy as that.
What do you mean?
You've forgotten. You wanted to know why I think Walter Marson murdered Thomas Lamar. Yes, you see, I happen to know Vonnie did not love Walter.
You just said she married him.
Unknown to her foster father.
What are you getting at?
Somewhere along the line, Walter Marson, shall we say, got something on Vonnie. What it was, I don't know. But he had a strange power over her, it seemed.
Larry, what are you talking about?
I don't know, Johnny. From the time Walter first started working for Thomas Lamar, I didn't trust him. And yet Tom seemed to have the most implicit faith in him. Walter was a good accountant, yes, handled many of Tom's personal investments, and handled them very well, too. Thomas paid him very well, rewarded him, always, when he made unusual profits.
Why not?
But Walter Marson made it plain from the beginning that he wanted to work his way into Thomas's shoes in the corporation, and this Thomas would not have.
And the reason?
Because Thomas knew that many of the stock deals Walter had made in his behalf were not completely, shall we say, legitimate, or legally proper, perhaps. But not morally so, that is.
Corporation money instead of his own, right?
Yeah, that's it. Buying huge blocks in order to inflate the price, and then dumping the stocks at their peak, that sort of thing. I don't know much of the details. That's out of my line. But Thomas knew very well that if Walter Marson were ever put into the corporation, he'd use the same slick methods for purely personal gain. At the expense of the corporation, he'd spent his life building up.
How do you know about this?
I was Thomas's confidant. His closest friend.
All right, Larry. Let me do a little summing up. Walter Marson failed to dig into Lamar's money via the corporation, so he married his daughter to be sure of latching on to the family fortune. And that's it.
Yes, it's as simple as that.
Therefore, you're sure this Marson poisoned Lamar?
Yes, and because of the findings of Dr. Ed Wilson.
Which haven't yet been verified.
Well, no.
And even if you do find proof that Lamar was poisoned, you have no proof that Marson was back of it.
No.
Larry, what if Vonnie had something to do with it?
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. That's a real possibility, isn't
Good
it?
Good heavens, Johnny, you can't mean that. You say you know the girl.
Yeah, sure. And I fell for her like a ton of bricks. Whether it's simply because I'm a sucker for such a charmer or just because she charmed me so well, I don't know. But why did she want me if she's already married?
Johnny, what are you getting at?
$1 million at stake. $1.5 million. How she could possibly have known I'd be staying at the La Crescenta in La Jolla, California, I don't know. But with $1.5 million at stake, you could find out most anything. So she worked on me, got me on her side, even before she needed to. And when her father died, according to plan, she knew there'd be no question of settlement of a claim for the insurance because of the way she'd so successfully drawn me into a cozy little noose.
Johnny, you're out of your mind.
Am I? What are you talking about, you old... Yeah, I guess I am.
John, I've been a confirmed bachelor all my life, even before I was your age. But I know very well that if I'd ever met Vonnie Lamar, my bachelor days would have suddenly ended. Oh, you're hurt. Now that you've found out she's married, you're hurt and you're angry. You're striking out at anything you can reach, anyone. And I'm sorry. Don't let it take away your judgment.
I'm sorry too, Larry. I didn't mean to... I really didn't...
It's all right, Johnny. But now get hold of yourself. You have a job to do, not only for me, for the company, but for yourself.
Okay, Larry, thanks.
Good boy.
I don't know what I'm going to do, but I guess whatever it is, I better start doing it.
Yes. Good luck, Jim.
No.
Now, here's our star to tell you about tomorrow's intriguing episode of this week's story.
Tomorrow? Well, it doesn't take long to find out what has to be done on this case, because the turning point in the whole thing comes straight to me, and with a vengeance. Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Truly, Johnny Dollar, starring Bob Bailey, is transcribed in Hollywood. It is produced and directed by Jack Johnstone, who also wrote tonight's story. Be sure to join us tomorrow night, same time and station, for the next exciting episode of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. Roy Rowan speaking.
And that's Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, from March 28, 1956, part three of this five-part adventure called The Lamar Matter, starring Bob Bailey.
Please salute our brave men and women fighting overseas for their support of the USA. This salute courtesy of a concerned citizen, John Wadzita, serving the U.S. Postal Service for over 38 years. John Wadzita is on the air saluting our troops.
More of the WGN Radio Theater after these words. In our next hour, Lisa, we'll tune into Life with Luigi, an April Fool's Day show as well, from April 1st, 1952. Then it's part four of the Lamar Matter on Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. That's all coming your way in our next hour. Stick around. Welcome back. This is hour four, and we have Life with Luigi in this hour and also Johnny Dollar. All right, well, you ready for Life with Luigi? Of course, April Fool's coming up.
And I hope your mom is listening, because I know that's her favorite.
Favorite show. This was a comedy series. J. Carroll Nash starred as newly naturalized American citizen Luigi Basco. He was living in Chicago. This show was brought to you, by Wrigley, which was a Chicago sponsor. And it all took place in Chicago. It was set right here. You hear, like, talking about Halsted Street. All that's great. Now, every single episode, it would start out with Luigi writing a letter to his Mamma Mia in Italy, telling about his adventures in America. And Luigi owned an antique shop. His sponsor, Pasquale, played by Alan Reed, had brought him here to America. He owned a spaghetti palace. And he had a daughter named Rosa. She was quite overweight, Lisa. And he wanted Luigi to marry his daughter, Rosa. And this happened on every episode. And Rosa was played by Jodie Gilbert. It was created by Cy Howard, who also created My Friend Irma, ran on radio from 1948 until 1953. And pretty much the whole run sponsored by Wrigley Spearmint Chewing Gum. This is a Life with Luigi episode from April 1st, 1952. It's called The April Fool's Joke. It does star J. Carroll Nash. Here's Life with Luigi.
The makers of Wrigley's Spearmint Chewing Gum invite you to enjoy Life with Luigi, a comedy show created by Cy Howard, directed by Mack Benoff, and starring that celebrated actor, Mr. J. Carroll Nash, with Alan Reed as Pasquale. Now, Wrigley's Spearmint Chewing Gum brings you Luigi, as he writes another letter describing his adventures in America to his Mama Basco in Italy.
Dear Mamma Mia, it's April 1st today in America, and I got a big saying. April showers bring me flowers. Well, with me, April 1st brings a gas, electric, and a telephone bills. Mamma Mia, I wish you could see all the mail I'm got this morning. Besides the bill, I'm got a lot of advertisements, like one card that says, bring this to your grocer, he's gonna give you 2 bars of soap free. If you give him a 25 cents. yes, it's one more letter I got, which was no belonging to me, and I'm open up by mistake. With some letter for my countryman, Pasquale, and is I had the $1 inside. Soon as I clean up my antique shop, I'm going to go into Pasquale's Spaghetti Palace and give him his letter.
I don't get it, Pasquale. See, what was the idea of shoving your own letter under this Basco's door?
Lefty, today is April Foolish Day, right?
Yeah.
Well, there you are. That's it. That little pupsqueak always likes to celebrate all the American holidays, so I'm going to let him celebrate April Foolish Day. I'm so smart, I should have won me the Pulitzer Prize.
Okay, so what do you want me to do?
Just to do like I told you, Lefty. Don't ask so many questions. This is going to be the easiest $5 you made since the Prohibition.
No, that ain't...
Quiet. Here comes the little greenhorn now. You better sit down at one of those tables and don't forget the signal.
Okay.
Hello, Pasquale.
Hello, little banana nose. Oh, you're looking beautiful this morning, Luigi. Shoes all shined up, pants are nice and pressed, bow tie, face shining, and long curly hair just begging for a poodle haircut.
Well, Pasquale, I'm glad you feel so good today. Here, I open up one of your letters by mistake.
What? Quick, hide the letter. Hurry up.
Huh? What's the matter, Pasquale? I'm did something wrong?
Worse than wrong. Wronger. Open up for somebody else's mail is a terrible crime in America.
Huh?
Violation of the refrigerator law.
What is this refrigerator law?
Using the mails to defrost.
You're making a joke.
No, Luigi. I'm just telling you, you should always remember... Break somebody's window. Pick a fight with a cop. Or rob a bank if you wanna. But never touch anybody else's mail. And you know why?
Why?
Because right away the FBI marks you AWOL.
AWOL? What's this mean?
Alien what opens the letters.
All I did was make a little mistake.
Little mistakes is no excuse in the law. It's a lucky thing you opened my letter, not a stranger's. Now, slip me the damage and nobody should see.
I'd like to hear the letter, Pasquale, just like I'm a fan of it.
That's from a Mr. Roberts, my steadiest customer. He says, dear Mr. Pasquale, enclose a fine of $50 of cash, which takes care of my spaghetti bill for March.
50? How, Pasquale, was only $1 in his side?
What? Luigi, I wouldn't mind to defend you on a letter opener charge, but never stealing the money. In America, it's called arson.
Arson?
Yes, and over $25 worth is worse. That's called larceny.
Larceny?
Of course. Now, I couldn't testify against you if you was to be my daughter's husband.
Huh?
Well, take your pick, arson, a larceny, or a parson.
You're just trying to scare me. Nothing wrong is happening.
Nothing wrong is happening, huh?
No.
Okay. You hear me? Okay.
Oh, pardon me, bud.
Huh? Who are you?
Well, I just happened to overhear the whole conversation, see? And I happen to be a postal office inspector, see?
Postal office inspector, see?
Don't mind him, Mr. Postal Office Inspector. By see, he means yes. I guess he didn't really believe you were a real officer.
Well, there it is, right on my driver's license. I'm afraid you're in trouble, bud.
Trouble?
Well, what do you say now, Mr. Know-it-all? What kind of trouble is he in, Mr. Officer? And please, be good to him.
Well, we give him a choice. 5 years or 10 years.
5 out of 10 years?
Well, Luigi, go ahead. You win the 5 and 10. Take your pick.
Come on, I'm gonna go get advice. Goodbye.
Hey, come here. I gotta make a pinch.
Pinch yourself. I'm gonna go to school.
Goodbye, Alcatraz. Ooh, what an April Foolish joke. Lefty, you couldn't act any better if you was Ethel the Barrymore. Hey, here's you $5.
Hey, thanks, Pasquale. Hey, you got that character real scared. Weren't you supposed to tell him the whole thing was just an April Fool's joke?
That's the way it started out, Lefty, but who knows? Maybe that April Fool could turn my daughter into a junior bride.
You're a
Please. I'll call the roll. Mr. Basco?
Here.
Mr. Horowitz?
Yeah.
Mr. Olson? Mr. Schultz?
I accept the nomination. Thank you, fellow boobers. And remember my promise. A vote for Schultz in November is a vote for chaos in December.
Mr. Schultz, that will be enough clowning.
Ach, smile, Miss Spalding. It's spring. The sun is shining. The birds are singing. Lovers are humming. The whole world is in tune.
You may answer the first question, Mr. Toscanini.
Me and my big mouth.
We are studying state capitals today, class. And Mr. Schultz, you... Mr. Basco, what's the matter?
Well, Miss Spalding, today I'm opening up a Pasquale's letter by mistake. Was it supposed to be $50 in a side? I'm found only one. But a Pasquale says Arsenal, Arsenal, the parson in the post office who wants to pinch me.
Oh, Luigi, are you for shimmered?
Believe it or not, Schultz, I understood him. Look, Luigi, anybody can make a mistake once in a while and open up a wrong letter.
Johor, that's true, by Yemeni. Yo, my nephew once opened up a letter and they sent him away for 3 years.
Really? Where was the letter from?
He's trapped, bored. Oh, that was a gigantic joke by Yemeni.
Very good, Olsen. Listen to them. Olsen and Horowitz. The United Nations, Martin and Lewis. Look, Luigi, I'm sure Pasquale won't make you no trouble. Just forget the whole thing.
I think so, too, Mr. Basco.
Yeah, but it's a $49 admission from my envelope. Miss Spalding, the inspectors are going to make him in trouble. I could tell it the way he's tried to grab me.
Luigi, be practical. Even if the post office inspector was there at the time and he did see everything, they can't do a thing to you unless Pasquale wants to prosecute.
Yeah, and for a measly $49, Pasquale wouldn't slap you in the clink, will he?
Sure, sir. You think he would?
Without a doubt. Pasquale would kill himself if he could only figure out a way to come back and collect the insurance.
Mamma mia, then I'm in a big trouble.
Shame on you, Mr. Schultz, frightening him like that.
Ach, smile, Luigi. I was only trying to make a joke.
Mr. Basco, the whole thing is just a misunderstanding. You talk to Mr. Pasquale after school. Tell him the truth. You found only $1 in the letter.
Yeah, but I'm already told him this.
Look, Luigi, maybe it dropped out. Did you look all over the store?
Yeah, all over, Horowitz.
Then you should look again. Leave no stone unturned.
That's what they say on the rock pile. Smile, Luigi. Nothing is going to come from all this, believe me.
Well, sure, so while Inspector was there, Pasquale has looked at me very strict. Like he thought I was a lion. I'm afraid that maybe he's going to let him put me in jail.
Why, that's ridiculous, Mr. Basco. Look, if you're so worried, why don't you go downtown to the main post office, see the officials there, and explain the whole thing to them?
Me? Go to the post office?
Sure, Luigi. 10 million Americans do it every day to fill their fountain pens.
That's right. You got nothing to lose, Luigi.
Sure, to be sure. The truth usually has a way of shining through.
That's right, Luigi. Tell him you got the letter. You opened it up by mistake. There was $1 inside, and that's what you gave for Pasquale.
But it sure's a weather for the inspector don't believe in me.
Well, then you get... Well... Ach, Luigi, stop worrying. We'll visit you in Alcatraz and call the roll every Sunday.
Before we return to Life with Luigi, here's a suggestion that'll make your daily work a little easier and more enjoyable. Chew refreshing Wrigley's Spearmint Gum while you work. You see, chewing on a good, smooth piece of Wrigley's Spearmint Gum just naturally helps keep you feeling right. It helps relieve that feeling of tension and pressure, gives you comfort and satisfaction. Then, too, Wrigley's Spearmint Gum has a lively, long-lasting, real spearmint flavor that freshens your mouth and help keep your throat moist. Yes, friends, that little stick of Wrigley's Spearmint Chewing Gum can be a real help to you while you're working. Try it and see for yourself. Chew Wrigley's Spearmint Gum on the job and see how the pleasant chewing makes your work go smoother and easier. let's turn to page 2 of Luigi Basco's letter to his mother in Italy.
Well, mamma mia, I've now got a worst day of my life in front of me. But before I go down the town to the post office to beg them they should believe me, I'm going to go see Pasquale. Right now, through the window, I can see he's calling somebody.
Rosa! Rosa! Rosa, come out of the kitchen.
You called me, Papa!
Yes, my little Cupid doll. Tell me, Rosa, did Luigi talk to you yet today?
Oh!
Oh, what's the matter, bambino?
Oh, Papa, you should tell Luigi it's an April Fool joke. He feels terrible.
Sure. And when he feels it terrible enough, he might decide to marry you. Rosa, this whole thing started as an April Foolish joke, but now the whole thing is bigger than the both of us. If that's possible.
Papa!
Quiet, here he comes now. Go back in the kitchen.
Yes, Papa.
Pasquale, you gotta believe in me, Pasquale, you gotta.
Believe you about what, little cabbage puss?
Pasquale, you know I didn't take you $49.
Sure, Luigi, I know you didn't take the money. How could you? After all, I look at you like my own son.
Oh, thank you, Pasquale.
Now give me back the money and I drop the charges.
But Pasquale, you just said...
Never mind what I said. Just listen to me. Far as I'm concerned, I'd be willing to forget the whole thing. But that J. Edgar Hoover's a cracking down on letter openers of this year.
Yeah, but Pasquale, I didn't...
Luigi, let me warn you. Don't say anything I might hold against you in a court.
Court? What's a court?
Who knows? There's lots of courts. You're in the soup, so I guess they're going to take you to the superior court. After all, Luigi, that's a terrible charge that they got against you. Housebreaking into a letter.
Pasquale, you don't believe in me. You don't believe in
Luigi,
nothing.
Luigi, believe me. I think you're innocent even though you're guilty. But in the eyes of the law, you are now what is called a habeas corpus.
Habeas corpus?
That's mean a half a corpse.
Mamma, Pasquale, please. Look, go down to town. Talk to this fella. Tell him how you was brought to me to America. And you don't think I'm took you money.
Now, is it too late, Luigi? Now you got a choice of 3 juries. There's the grand. That's for people who steal over $1,000. Then there's the blue ribbon jury, which tries mostly beer cases. And then, Luigi, they got the hung jury.
Hung jury?
Yes, they hang you first to try you later.
No, Pasquale, now I know you're making a joke of him, the whole thing. You don't care what's happening to me.
No, don't say that, Luigi. I feel very sorry for you. If I was in your boots now, you know what I'd do? I would have gone down to Lake Michigan, hire one of those $0.50 an hour rowboats, and aim for Italy.
Goodbye, my good friend.
Oh, wait, Luigi, come back. Where are you going?
To the post office to beg you for my life.
Yes, sir. How many stamps, sir?
No, thanks. I'm going to talk to the boss. Is he in?
Well, you want the superintendent?
Huh? What am I going to do with a janitor?
The superintendent is in charge of this office, sir.
Oh, he's the biggest boss, huh?
Well, no. Above him, there's the 4th assistant postmaster, and his superior is the 3rd assistant postmaster. Then there's the 2nd assistant postmaster, and above him is the 1st assistant postmaster.
And he's the biggest, huh?
No. The top man is the postmaster general.
Oh. When they get a too big army, is drafted them, huh?
Sir, if you tell me what your problem is, I might be able to direct you.
Well, mister, it's about a letter. I'm open up by mistake.
Oh, do you have the letter?
No, I think maybe the inspector took it.
What inspector?
From the post office.
Do you know his name?
Sure, Mr. Lefty.
Left room? I think you want to see the chief inspector, Mr. Simmons, sir. He's in room 214 upstairs.
Oh, thank you. And I'm going to buy 3 stamps, please.
Oh, good. Good. What kind?
Any kind. I don't like it to come into your post office and to take up your time without giving you some little business. Excuse me, Mr. Inspector. Can I come inside your office? I'm going to ask you something.
All right. What can I do for you, sir?
My name is Luigi Basco, and I'm coming to tell you about Pasquale's letter, which I'm opening up by mistake, but there wasn't no $49 inside. Just a $1 bill with the Mr. Washington as a picture. Believe me, that was all that was in
it. Well, let's see if we can't get some facts down. Your name, please?
Luigi Basco.
How do you spell that?
Luigi Basco, that's a big L and a big B. Everything else is a tiny with a 2 dots on the top of I.
Luigi Basco, okay. Address?
21 in North Hollister Street.
Is that Chicago 1?
You mean there's a 2 Chicago?
I meant the zone number, Mr. Basco.
Oh, that's a number 22.
Oh, now then, Mr. Basco, calm down. Begin at the beginning and tell me the whole story.
Well, from the beginning, Pasquale's letter was coming to me by mistake, and I'm open up by mistake. And your inspector was there.
My inspector? What was his name?
Mr. Lefty.
The name isn't familiar. What do you look like?
He's wore a green pants, a checker coat, sweaty shoes, a big cigar. I think he's a work on a railroad sometimes.
On the railroad?
Yeah, in his hand there was a carry newspaper says tips at the track.
There's no such inspector working out of this office. Now, Mr. Basco, since the department has already taken steps in your case, I'm afraid my hands are tied.
Oh, then please, take the ropes up. Please help me. I'm not yet a citizen, and I don't want to get into trouble with the government.
Mr. Basco, I can't do a thing for you.
And then maybe you're going to talk to Pasquale, huh? Tell him I didn't take the money. Tell him
that... Mr. Basco, you're just wasting time now.
Mr. Chief, I'm going to promise you, if you help me, I'm going to help you back. I'm going to write to my mama 3 times a day, special delivery, air mail. You're going to make so much money from me, you're going to retire in 1 year.
Mr. Basco, for the last time, there is nothing I can do for you. Now go home and wait till the department sends for you.
Yes, Mr. Chief. But don't worry. I'm still going to buy my stamps from you.
Hello, Luigi.
Hello, Rosa. What's the matter, Rosa? You got a toothache?
Papa told me you were going to hire a rowboat and row to Italy.
And you was worried about me, Rosa?
Yeah. It's $0.50 now, and I know you haven't got enough money for the whole trip.
Rosa, I'm in a terrible, terrible trouble.
No, Luigi, you're not.
Huh?
The whole thing's an April Fool's joke. Papa told me.
April Fool? You mean Pasquale's never had a $50 in that?
No. Papa slipped the letter under your door.
But that inspector.
That's Lefty from the pool room. Papa gave him $5 to be an inspector.
Mamma mia. How rusty you done another, but you just gave me back America. Oh, Rosie, you never was look so good to me like you look right now. And Rosie, I'm going to kiss you. On your birthday. Hey, look, Rosie, you want to help me play a little joke on you, Papa?
What kind of joke, Luigi?
April Fool's joke, Rosie.
All right, but please don't tell Papa I told you.
No, don't worry. First I'm going to see Chief Inspector, then I'm going to see some of my friends, then it's going to start all of the fun.
Luigi!
What?
Are you really going to kiss me on my birthday?
When is your birthday, Rosa?
Next December.
You got my promise. Oh.
Yeah, what's this about Luigi?
Did he really run away?
That a crazy kid. Read this suicidal note he left me after he died.
Let me see that, Pasquale.
Dear Pasquale, you was right. I got it no choice, so I'm gonna hire a rowboat and row to Italy. Jiminy, he is a brave man. Yes, I hope the tide is with him. Here, Pasquale, you finish the letter. I ain't got the heart to. All right. Friends, don't be too hard with Pasquale. He thinks I really stole his $49. Oh, listen, you stupid letter. I don't think. The whole thing is just April Fool's joke.
What?
Pasquale, you have a very stupid, cruel sense of humor.
That's right. You sent Luigi 5,000 miles in a rowboat.
And that's carrying a joke too far. Who figured it would take the whole thing so serious? I only... just a plain little April Fool's joke.
Schultz, what else did he write?
He wrote a P.S. That's a standard for Pasquale. P.S. Everything I got in the world, I leave to the best friend I ever had. Pasquale. Don't, Schultz. That's enough. Read on, Schultz. Please read on.
Sure. Read more.
Wait a minute. I gotta wring out my handkerchief. Schultz, what's gonna happen with Luigi?
Pasquale, what has got to be has got to be.
What? You know, we got a thing in the delicatessen business. If you were born to be a salami, you'll never wind up in the army.
Very funny, Schultz, very funny.
Oh, you were on with the genius, with the yolk, Schultz.
Oh, stop it there, you crazy maroons, you. How can you stand there and laugh when Luigi might be floating right now on the bottom of the ocean?
Ah, stop tying on so much, Pasquale. It ain't as if Luigi was the last fella in the world for Rosa.
That's the trouble, he was. I gotta call up with the police department, the fire department.
Pasquale, come here.
Let me go.
All right. Which one of you is Pasquale?
Huh? Who's this? Lefty, what do you do with this fella?
Jig is up, Pasquale.
I'm what? Chief Inspector Simmons, United States Post Office, and your Confederate Lefty here has already confessed and incriminated you.
He's not incriminating me. I didn't do nothing.
Mr. Pasquale, it's a criminal offense to use the mails as a medium for practical jokes.
That's a lie. I never slipped that letter under Luigi's door, and I got 12 witnesses who didn't see me do it.
It's too bad Luigi ain't here to testify against you, Pasquale.
But I am alive. What? In my own way.
Who said that?
Who said what, Pasquale?
Give up, Pasquale. Tell them how you was killed me.
He's here. Oh, Pasquale.
Yeah, he didn't hear nobody.
Luigi. That's the matter. You all deaf? Don't you hear him? Mr. Inspector, you heard him?
Mr. Pasquale. It's just your conscience.
My conscience? No, it can't be.
Yes, it can be.
What? Well, who's that?
Hello from Hollywood to all of you. This is the Well of Parsons, my first exclusive. Mr. Pasquale killed Mr. Luigi Basso. Shame on him.
Luella Parsons. If she's a no, everybody's a no. All right, take him away, Inspector. I killed. Take him away.
April the Fool, Pasquale.
Luigi. You was in the closet all the time.
Sure, and I was a-talking in this empty milk bottle like a this, you see.
Confess, Pasquale, confess.
I knew it all the time, Luigi. You never fooled me once. Say, where's Luella Parsons?
Where's Luella Parsons?
Yeah.
I'm a no-no.
Wasn't she in the closet with you?
No.
Oh.
Hey, what do you know? He feigned it.
All right, Luigi. Now, you can tell me, where is Miss Barson?
For a shucks, I'm going to know. I'm going to even hear her voice.
In just a minute, we'll explain the mystery of Luella Parsons' voice. The makers of Wrigley's Spearmint Chewing Gum invite you to be sure to listen next week at this time when Luigi Basco writes another letter to his Mama Basco in Italy. Life with Luigi is a Cy Howard production. Pat Burton is associate producer. The script is written by Mac Benoff and Lou Derman and directed by Mr. Benoff. J. Carroll Nash is starred as Luigi Basco and Alan Reed as Pasquale, Hans Conried as Joe, Jody Gilbert as Rosa, Mary Schiff as Miss Spaulding, Joe Forte as Horowitz, and Ken Peters as Olson. The music is under the direction of Lud Gluskin. Friends, now we can clear up the mystery of Miss Luella Parsons' voice. It came from CBS Radio. In fact, right from Luigi's closet. And we wish to thank her for her appearance in our program tonight. Luella's new program of outstanding Hollywood news starts tonight on CBS Radio, immediately after this program. We hope you'll all stay tuned for the Luella Parsons program. This is Charles Lyon. This is the CBS Radio Network.
And that's Life with Luigi, April 1st, 1952, an April Fool's joke, starring J. Carroll Nash, also in that cast, Alan Reed as Pasquale. Yes, that was the voice of Fred Flintstone. Every time I hear his voice,
it sounds the same.
Oh, I know.
Mean, he sounds like he's Fred Flintstone.
He used the same exact voice for Fred Flintstone. Yeah, hope you enjoy that as heard on CBS. All right, we are up to part four now of this five-part adventure called The Lamar Matter on Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, starring Bob Bailey. Here you go.
From Hollywood, it's time now for...
Johnny Dollar.
Dr. Edward Wilson, Mr. Dollar.
Oh, hello, Doctor.
Mr. Comstock of Tri-Mutual Insurance asked me to call you.
Regarding the death of Thomas Rene Lamar.
Yes. I've just left the police department. The chief autopsy surgeon...
Yes?
There's no question about it. Thomas Lamar was poisoned.
I see. I'd like to talk to you, Doctor. I understand you were one of Mr. Lamar's closest friends.
Yes.
And one of the beneficiaries of his will.
That's quite... Where did you learn that?
I didn't. It was a shot in the dark.
Oh, look here, young...
Better stick close to your office, Doctor. I'm on my way over to see you.
Tonight and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account, America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator...
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar to the Home Office, Universal Adjustment Bureau, Hartford, Connecticut. Assignment, the Lamar matter, now proven to be murder. As the facts of this case lined up, it appeared that Thomas Rene Lamar, wealthy manufacturer of aircraft components, had only two really good friends. Lawrence Comstock, who had issued him $1.5 million worth of life insurance policies, and Dr. Edward T. Wilson, and a wonderful, lovely, charming adopted daughter, Lavon, whom I'd met during my brief vacation in La Jolla, California, whom I'd accompanied back here to South Bend, Indiana, when she received word of her father's sudden death. What little evidence I'd been able to pick up seemed to point to one Walter Marson, Lamar's personal secretary. Unknown to Lamar, he had married Bonnie, and therefore stood to benefit from his death. Oh, why kid about it? I'd fallen for the girl, heavily. And when I found out that she was already married to a slick, smart promoter, well, let's keep personalities out of this case, especially mine. I'd told Vonnie that I'd come up and see her out at the family mansion, but I thought I'd better contact Dr. Wilson first.
Come in. Come in, Mr. Dollar. I've heard a great deal about you from Lawrence Comstock.
Please, sit down.
Thanks, Doctor.
You said something over the phone that has bothered me.
I won't mince words. Apparently, you and Larry Comstock were Thomas Lamar's closest friends.
I don't think there's any question about it, my boy. And I'm sure Lawrence will verify that.
He already has. That's why I took a shot in the dark and suggested that you're a beneficiary of Lamar's will, not his insurance. I already know that his daughter Vonnie gets that, but his will.
Well, does that shock you, or...
I suppose Larry's a beneficiary, too.
Yes?
Then either one of you might conceivably have had a motive for bringing about his death.
What? Now, just a minute,
relax,
young man.
Relax, Doctor, relax. I make no bones about it. This is the roughest case I ever tried to handle. Unfortunately, I started out by getting myself emotionally involved with Vonnie Lamar. Go ahead and laugh if you want to.
Hardly. She's a very wonderful girl. A bit mixed up at times, perhaps, because of...
Well, because of what?
Are you aware that unknown to her father, Vonnie was married? Is married?
Yes, to some Walter Marson, Larry Comstock told me.
Marson was Thomas Lamar's personal secretary. Did Lawrence tell you why she married him?
I don't think he knows.
It was a few short months after Thomas Lamar's wife died. A terrible blow both to Vonnie, who was completely devoted to her foster mother, and to him. By way of quenching his sorrow, Thomas drove himself in his work, 16, 18 hours a day at the plant, all his waking hours, so that he would have time to think of nothing but his work. But Vonnie had no such outlet for her emotions. Her friends, a lot of rich ne'er-do-wells, rich, worthless bums, if you like, got her interested in gambling. She plunged into it with a recklessness and abandon that quickly got her into debt so deeply that, well, there was only one way out.
Her father didn't know?
No. But young Marson did, and he took full advantage of it. In return for her agreement to marry him, he promised to quietly obtain the necessary funds from Thomas Lamar's investments, which he, Marson, handled. And he did.
And she married him?
Yes.
But how could she? She didn't love him.
And you must realize her emotional state at that time. She was terribly upset over the recent death of her mother, and so was her father, of course. She knew the shock it would be if he ever knew of her gambling and the tremendous debt she'd incurred. She was beside herself, ready to do anything.
So she married Marson. I could kill him.
Now, let's get one thing straight, Mr. Dollar.
Yes?
You, too, were a bit upset when you came in here. You spoke as though you might think both Lawrence Comstock and I could have motive for wanting Thomas's death.
I'm sorry, Doctor.
It's true that we are beneficiaries of his will, at least Thomas assured us we were, but only in a very minor way. Thomas was loyal to us as he was to the servants who have been so devoted to him for so long, and whatever little he has left us and them...
I'm sorry, Doctor. I guess I was just feeling hurt and angry and taking it out on anyone I could find. At least that's the way Larry Comstock put it. And he was right. Now I got a job to do. What have the police found out?
Only enough to back up my immediate suspicion that Thomas was poisoned by pyrodamron.
Pyrodamron?
Yes, it's a little-known drug that produces tremendous but only momentary stimulation to the heart, causes the heart to almost literally burst, and it leaves virtually no traceable residue in the system.
But you said the chief autopsy surgeon found out...
No. He found only positive indication that pyrodamron had been used. I found the first clue to it only minutes after Thomas died. A staining of the tongue that even then was rapidly disappearing.
Can you tie this drug in with Walter Marson?
No, the fact that it was available at all has stumped both the police and myself. The last known source was a small island off the coast of Greece many, many years ago. And all the tiny plants from which it could be obtained as pollen were burned by the Greek government.
But somebody, somewhere, must have had some seeds, planted them, and obtained this pollen.
Yes.
How do you suppose Mr. Lamar took the stuff?
Well, it could have been mixed with one of the medicines in the cabinet in his bathroom, but we found no traces.
Larry Comstock said you used to give him harmless sugar pills as a kind of sedative.
Yes. Thomas knew they were perfectly harmless, but he occasionally took them anyway. It was a kind of joke.
Could this pyrus stuff have been mixed with them?
We found no trace in the bottle.
But you would have been able to.
Yes. It is only in assimilation by the human body that dissipation is so complete as to make it virtually undetectable. I'm afraid I haven't been of much help to you, Mr. Dollar.
I think you have, Doctor. I think you have. It was only a hunch, But in this business, you sometimes have to depend as much on hunches as on common sense. I picked out the library nearest to the Lamar residence to do my research.
Pyrodameron. You're sure that is the word?
Yes. Can't you find anything on the subject?
Nothing beyond what you found in the Pharmacopoeia Index, the name of the plant from which it is derived. Blephara purpurus calandus. No common name.
Yeah, I know. Well, thanks.
Of course, the main branch of the city library in Chicago might have something.
Sure, thanks.
Why, yes, I'm sure I can find what you're looking for. You see, I myself am quite a student of rare drugs and poisons.
Oh, what's that?
Well, after a long, dull day here at the library, I enjoy nothing more than curling up in a big chair in my little apartment and reading detective fiction.
Oh. Well, where's the book?
I'll show you. But quietly, please. We must maintain the proper atmosphere for our readers.
Oh, sure.
Yes, I know the poison pyrodameron very well. It was used in that wonderful story, The Case of the Yellow-Lipped Monster. Oh, excellent book. Thrilling. Oh, you should read it.
Yeah, well,
Pyrodameron was new to me, so as usual, I had to find out all about it, and I did find out, too. The plant it's derived from, where it's grown, where it was grown. You see, it's been extinct now for many years.
Yeah, I understand. Oh, now,
deadly thing, terribly deadly. But now, here is the book that will tell you all about it. The title is Flora Exotica Mediterranea. That means exotic flowers of the Mediterranean. Flora Exotica Mediterranea.
What's the matter?
I don't... Oh, good heavens, it isn't here.
You sure?
But it was. I'm sure it was only yesterday. Oh, dear. Well, here, do you see? It was taken out from right here.
Well, who took it out?
I don't know.
Won't your record show?
No, I never permit any books to be taken from this section without my knowledge. Never.
Afraid somebody'd consult the stuff for ulterior motives?
Oh, dear, no. It's just that the only ones who want these books are the rabid whodunit fans like myself, and, well, I like to talk to them.
Well, isn't there some other book that might give me the information I want?
Oh, not another book in the world. I know. And now, oh, tragedy, it's been stolen.
Well, this was one time a hunch didn't pay off. Quite the contrary. I'd wasted a lot of time. Expense account item 9, 520, taxi out to the Lamar mansion. I was almost relieved to learn that Vonnie was not home.
I'm very sorry, sir, but she and Mr. Marson left shortly afternoon to make the funeral arrangements.
Thank you, Harrison.
However, as you know, Miss Vonnie wished you to have full access to the house, and if you care to wait...
How is she holding up, Harrison?
Most admirably, Mr. Dollar, under the circumstances. Mr. Lamar's passing has been a terrible thing for her. For all of us.
Yes, sure, of course.
What'll happen to the house, I don't know.
Won't Miss Lamar continue to live in it?
This morning she said no, that she'd travel for a while, and then settle down somewhere else, far away from this city.
Oh? And what about you, the servants?
Oh, we shall, of course, have to seek employment elsewhere.
Say, tell me, Harrison, didn't Mr. Lamar provide for you in his will?
I do not know, sir, and I do not particularly care. His kindness and loyalty to us during his lifetime was far more important than any provision he may have made for us.
Well, I guess that takes you off the list.
Beg pardon?
Nothing. So tell me, has Walter Marson been around much since Mr. Lamar's death?
Yes, he's been most attentive to Miss Lamar, which we've all appreciated. He lives here in the house, you know.
No, I didn't know. Harrison, I'd like to see his room.
Sir?
I'm going to lay my cards right on the table. I'm an insurance investigator. Here. My card.
Why, I see. Miss Vonnie hadn't so informed me.
Because she didn't know.
Well, sir,
now show me to Marson's room.
Yes, sir. This way, please.
Do you like Walter Marson?
Yes, sir, very much. Now.
What does that mean?
I've never spoken of this to anyone else, Mr. Dollar. For years, Walter Marson was a clever, scheming, conniving young man with overpowering ambition to take over the Lamar Corporation.
So I've heard.
I'm convinced that at one time he even tried to marry Miss Lamar, and solely for the purpose of forcing his way into the business.
Just trying to...
Well, yes, sir. However, in the past year or two, Mr. Marson has changed completely.
What makes you think so?
Because of conversations between him and Mr. Lamar that I could not avoid overhearing from time to time. Mr. Lamar knew what Marson was attempting and faced him with his knowledge of it. Here is his room.
Go on.
Mr. Lamar could have made it very difficult for him in view of his record.
Prison record?
Yes, sir, for embezzlement. But instead, he gave the young man another chance.
So? Go on.
And Mr. Marson made the most of it. He changed completely. I say without reservation, sir, that Mr. Marson is as honorable a young man as I know.
Pretty sure of that, aren't you?
Yes, sir. A butler living as close to them both for so long can invariably... Pardon me, sir, but does something give you the reason to think I'm mistaken?
No, no. Unless perhaps it's this book I just found lying on his desk.
Book, sir.
Flora Exotica Mediterranea.
Now, here's our star to tell you about the final intriguing episode of this week's story.
Tomorrow, the wind-up, and a switch that will make your head spin. Join us, won't you? Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, starring Bob Bailey, is transcribed in Hollywood. It is produced and directed by Jack Johnstone, who also wrote tonight's story. Be sure to join us tomorrow night, same time and station, for the next exciting episode of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar. Roy Rowan speaking.
That's Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, part four of the Lamar Matter, a five-part adventure starring Bob Bailey from March 29th, 1956.
Please salute our brave men and women fighting overseas for their support of the USA. This salute, courtesy of a concerned citizen, John Wadzita, serving the U.S. Postal Service for over 38 years. John Wadzita is on the air saluting our troops.
More of the WGN Radio Theater after these words. Well, in our next hour, Hour 5, we'll tune in to The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, starring Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce in an April Fool's show.
There's a theme here.
Yeah,
I'm detecting a little April Fool thing.
That's because I'm kind of a fool.
I know. You took my joke.
I'm a little foolish. We'll tune in to Sherlock Holmes plus part five, the conclusion of Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar, with a Lamar Matter. That is in our next hour, and you'll hear it right after the news. Hour five of the WGN Radio Theater, and in this hour, we will tune in to The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes from April 1st, 1946, an April Fool's Day adventure starring Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce. They, of course, Lisa, were playing Sherlock Holmes and Watson in a series of movies brought to you by Fox and Universal, and they were doing double duty on the radio playing the characters in a very popular series in the 1940s. Then we'll tune into the conclusion of the Lamar Matter on this five-part Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar adventure from 1956, starring Bob Bailey. It's all coming your way after these words. Welcome back to the WGN Radio Theater. Want to remind you that there are five classic radio shows waiting for you at 100radioshows.com. Right, Lisa?
Right. Would you like to know what they are, Carl?
Yes. I want to see if you know what they are.
All right. We've got Richard Diamond, Private Detective, Fibber McGee and Molly, Suspense, Gunsmoke, and Don't Tell Me. What did I forget?
Did you say Richard Diamond, Private Detective?
I did.
Fibber McGee and Molly?
I said that.
Gunsmoke?
I did.
Jack Benny?
Jack Benny. How do you forget Jack Benny?
Yeah, and Gunsmoke.
Gunsmoke.
Don't forget Jack Benny.
I won't forget.
Greatest comedy show in the history
terrible.
Of radio.
That was
five
terrible.
Shows are waiting for you at 100radioshows.com. Just put your email in. You'll get these shows sent to you instantly. And if you want to buy any of the other shows?
You can do that. You can browse through the other radio shows for sale. There's hundreds of them, but make sure to put the promo code RADIO. You will save 70%. But don't forget, there's a free Jack Benny show waiting for you. You just need your email.
And make sure when you use that promo code, it's at checkout, and
right.
You'll save 70% on your order. So check that out. But it's time now, Lisa, for the Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, Good Detective series, came to radio originally in 1930. Imagine that?
That was
dramatic
very early.
Show on the radio in 1930. And Richard Gordon first played Sherlock Holmes, but by 1939, Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce, who were simultaneously starring in a popular series of Sherlock Holmes movies, started playing the roles on radio as well. Tom Conway took over in the mid-1940s, and then John Stanley and Alfred Shirley. We have an April Fool's Day adventure starring Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce from April 1st, 1946. Here's the Adventures of Sherlock Holmes.
Petri Wine brings you Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce in the new Adventures of Sherlock Holmes. The Petri family, the family that took time to bring you good wine, invite you to listen to Dr. Watson tell us another exciting adventure he shared with his old friend, that master detective, Sherlock Holmes. And right now, I'd like to just briefly mention an idea you ought to try tomorrow night, just before you sit down to dinner. Just pour yourself a glass of that good Petri California sherry. Petri sherry is the perfect before-dinner wine. Its cheerful, glowing amber color looks festive and, well, it sort of lends an air of importance to the occasion. And as for the wine itself, just taste it. That Petri sherry is not just ordinary wine, no, sir. One sip and you know that wonderful sun-ripened grapes went into its making. Yes, and you know that Petri sherry was carefully watched over every step of the way. Incidentally, Petri makes two kinds of sherry. Regular sherry and Petri Pale Dry. If you're not sure just which kind you and your friends will like best, try them both. Don't buy one, buy two. But when it comes to sherry, or any other wine for that matter, be sure you always buy Petri. And now I'm certain our good friend Dr. Watson's waiting for us. Let's go in and join him.
Come in. Ah, there you are, Mr. Bartell. Punctual to the minute, as always.
Well, this is one doctor's appointment I'm eager to keep.
That's nice of you to say so, my boy. Draw up your usual chair and make yourself comfortable.
Thanks. Well, Doctor, today's April the 1st. Did anyone try and play any jokes on you?
Yes, he did, Mr. Bartell, but I'm happy to say that nobody caught me. Not as in the story that I'm going to tell you tonight. But an April Fool's Day prank certainly scored a bullseye.
I see you have the dispatch box out again, Doctor. Been refreshing your memory?
Yes, I have, Mr. Bartell. And when I tell you the adventure took place at 1881, I think you'll agree that after such a lapse of time, a man can hardly rely on memory alone.
1881? Say, Doctor, tonight's adventure must have been one of the really early ones.
Yes, it was indeed. In fact, to be exact, it took place only a little while after Sherlock Holmes and I had first met and taken up lodgings together.
How was the great detective in those early days?
Profound mystery to me, Mr. Bartell. To give you an example, my boy, I'd shared our Baker Street lodgings with him for over a month before I was even certain of his profession, the knowledge of which I learnt to my awe and astonishment when our first adventure together took place.
Oh, that was the one you called a study in scarlet, wasn't it,
That's
Doctor?
That's right, Mr. Bartell. What a memory you got, study in scarlet. But even after that adventure, I found myself wondering at times what I had let myself in for, sharing lodgings with such a strange companion. It was in one of those moods of doubt and confusion that my story begins. Late one March evening, I found myself in the neighborhood of Piccadilly Circus. It was cold, and a steady drizzle of rain had dampened my spirits. I felt that a glass of wine and the sound of music would put me in a better mood. And so, Mr. Bartell, I entered the Criterion restaurant. As I sat with a glass of rare vintage port at my elbow, the orchestra playing a dreamy Strauss waltz in the background, I couldn't help thinking of the last time that I'd been there. It was the night I met a young medical student by the name of Stamford. He was the man who first introduced me to Sherlock Holmes. Suddenly, I felt a clap on my shoulder. I turned, and to my amazement, once again, young Stamford was standing before me.
Why,
Watson, or should I say Dr. Watson. How are you, my dear chap?
Hello, Stamford. Come and sit down.
Thanks. I'm glad to see that you're not holding any grudge against me.
Why on earth should I do that?
For introducing you to Sherlock Holmes. I've reproached myself ever since. I think he's as mad as a hatter.
Not at all. He may be eccentric. In fact, I'll admit that he is eccentric, but he's an extraordinarily interesting fellow. He'll make a great name for himself as a private detective one of these days. You'll see if I'm not right, Stamford.
I saw something about him in the paper the other day.
Yes, I expect that was the Lauriston Gardens affair, wasn't it?
Yes, yes, it was.
He's a brilliant man, Stamford. Quite brilliant. Mm. Though I must admit he's difficult at times. He works like a fiend as a rule, but occasionally a reaction sets in and for days at a time. He'll lie on our sofa, hardly uttering a word or moving a muscle from morning to night. It's a bit depressing, I must say.
I think he takes himself too seriously.
Yes, perhaps you're right.
How would you like to join in a little plot?
Plot against Holmes?
Yes, yes. Just a rag, you know. We thought it'd be rather fun.
We?
Murphy and I. We were just talking about it. I'll call him over. Murphy?
Oh, is that Murphy? I've seen him before somewhere, haven't I?
I'm sure you must have done. He's been round at the hospital, and any time you go into the British Museum, you'll find him there. Nice fella, but dull. Definitely dull.
Yes, Stamford.
Oh, this is a friend of mine, John Watson. This is James Murphy.
How do you do? I think I've seen you at the hospital.
And I know I've seen you, Dr. Watson.
Oh, sit down and come and join us, won't you?
Oh, thank you very much.
I was just telling Watson about our little plot.
Oh, you mean about Sherlock Holmes?
Now, look here. I'd like you fellows to realize that Holmes is a very good friend of mine.
Oh, don't worry, Watson. This is all in good fun. Don't you realize what the date is tomorrow?
1st of April, isn't it?
Yes, April Fool's Day.
Oh, now I see. You're going to play an April Fool's Day joke on Holmes.
Yes, that's our plan.
Well, it's hardly our plan, Stamford. It's really Lady Anne Partington's idea. You see, Holmes was very rude to her when she visited the hospital recently, and she wants to, take him down a peg or two.
Oh, sounds innocent enough. I must say, he is inclined to be rather arrogant at times. Well, what's the plan?
Well, we'll need your help, Watson. You must be careful not to give the joke away. I'll bet you a fiver that Holmes falls for the whole story, hook, line, and sinker. Now, here's exactly what we're planning to do. Lady Anne is going to call on Holmes at Baker Street in the morning.
Lady Anne, I'm very flattered that you called to see me in my professional capacity.
Surely, my dear man, you didn't think this was a social call. You were much too rude to me at the hospital the other day for that.
That was the point I was trying to make. Please sit down, won't you?
Please, take this chair, won't you, Lady Anne? It's by far the most comfortable chair in the room.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Watson.
And now, what can I do to help you?
You've heard of the Elphinstone Emerald.
Oh, yes, yes, indeed. A magnificent stone of very considerable value. An heirloom in your family, I believe.
Yes, Mr. Holmes. I keep it in a wall safe in my bedroom. This morning, when I had occasion to go to the safe, I discovered that the emerald had been stolen.
Stolen? Good Scott. What a shocking business. Of course you want Mr. Holmes to recover it for you.
A remarkable deduction, my dear doctor. Lady Anne, when you opened the safe, did you observe any signs of it having been tampered with?
Oh, I think it's rather stupid to sit and answer questions here in Baker Street. Why don't you come over to my house in Cavendish Square and examine the safe for yourself? You are a detective, aren't you?
Lady Anne, just now you accused me of rudeness. I assure you that mine at least was unintentional.
Oh, come, Holmes. Don't be so touchy.
I can promise you a substantial fee, Mr. Holmes.
I'm a struggling practitioner and a new profession, eh? My poverty, but not my will, consents.
I pay thy poverty and not thy will. You see, I can quote my Shakespeare too, Mr. Holmes. My carriage is waiting, gentlemen. Let's drive over to Cavendish Square at once, shall we? This is the wall safe, Mr. Holmes.
Not too difficult a safe to crack for an expert. You placed the emerald in it last night, you say?
Yes, when I went to bed. And this morning, it had gone.
Well, surely, Holmes, this is a good occasion to use that magnifying glass that you're always fitting about.
Excellent occasion, my dear doctor. That's why I brought it with me. Uh-huh. That's very interesting.
What is it?
This safe was opened by an expert. There isn't a sign of its having been forced. Hello.
What have you discovered?
There's a peculiar tarnish on the steel knob. It was obviously handled by someone whose fingers are habitually stained with chemicals.
Amazing, Holmes.
Elementary, my dear doctor. Where does that door lead to?
My boudoir.
I should like to examine it, if I may.
Oh, but of course.
Thank you, Lady Anne.
Dr. Watson, this is the most beautiful April Fool's Day fraud I've ever played.
I must say, Murphy was right. He has fallen for it. Hook, line, and sinker. Just the same, I'm beginning to feel guilty. I can't help feeling a bit disloyal.
Oh, nonsense. It's all in fun.
Are Stamford and Mr. Murphy listening?
Yes, they're next door in my drawing room. I'm sure their ears are positively glued to the keyhole.
Well, I do hope Holmes won't be angry with me.
Shh, here he comes.
Nothing of any interest in there. The windows haven't been tampered with. We may presume, therefore, that the thief did not enter by an upstairs window. Lady Anne.
Yes, Mr. Holmes.
This room has not been touched since you discovered your loss?
Oh, no. I told the servants to leave it exactly as it was while I came to fetch you.
Splendid, splendid. Deep pile carpet, eh? Couldn't be better. The thief was a tall man with a long stride.
Oh, come, 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 Holmes. I know your methods, but there aren't any footprints on this carpet that you can identify, even with your magnifying glass.
My dear doctor, I've studied many crimes, and I've never seen one yet that was committed by a flying creature. As long as a criminal remains upon his two legs, there must be some trifling displacement which can be detected by a keen observer. I assure you that the marks on this carpet indicate that the thief was a tall man with a long stride. Traces of tobacco ash. Pipe tobacco. Shag tobacco that sells at fourpence an ounce.
Now, really, Mr. Holmes, how can you possibly identify an individual tobacco?
Oh, it's a hobby of mine. In fact, I've even written a monograph on the subject. Now, one more look at the thief itself. Hello. What's this powdered dust here? What? It's rosin. A distinct trace of rosin. Lady Anne, I suggest that you get in touch with Scotland Yard at once.
You mean that you've solved it, Holmes?
I mean, my dear doctor, that I can give you a reasonably complete picture of the thief, and that picture is so individual that I'd be surprised if it would fit more than one man in London.
This is pure magic, Mr. Holmes. Please describe him to me.
Well, he's a tall man. The width of his stride indicates that, and he's thin.
Well, what enables you to tell that, Holmes?
His footprints have made a remarkably light indentation on the nap of the carpet. Our thief dabbles extensively in chemicals, as indicated by the tarnishing of the knob on the safe, and the traces of rosin would suggest that he plays the violin also. He smokes shag tobacco, has a great practical knowledge of the ways of combination locks, and he's obviously in close contact with the criminal classes.
How do you know that, Mr. Holmes?
Well, he wouldn't steal a famous stone unless he knew how to dispose of it through some trustworthy fence.
Yes, it's a very comprehensive picture, Holmes. I almost feel as if I knew the chap.
Thank you, Doctor. I'm sure there's only one man in London, and it shouldn't be hard to trace him.
I agree entirely, Mr. Holmes. Dr. Watson, I think the joke has gone far enough.
Joke? What do you mean?
You're quite right, Holmes, in saying there's only one such man in London. You've just given a perfect description of yourself.
April Fool. Dr. Stamford, Mr. Murphy, you can come in now.
April Fool, huh?
April Fool.
April Fool.
Come along here. Into the drawing room, everyone. Let us drink a glass of wine to Mr. Holmes, who has so graciously forgiven us for the little trick we played on him. And also to Dr. Stamford, who thought of the whole idea.
No hard feelings, Holmes.
Oh, no, Doctor. Though it was a rather embarrassing experience.
Yes, when Murphy told me about the plan, I just couldn't resist joining him.
Ah, here you are, Holmes. Here's a drink.
Thank you, Stamford.
You know Murphy, don't you?
No, I don't think we've met. Oh. How'd you do, sir?
How'd you do, Holmes? How did you like the little game we played on you?
It was rather a salutary experience. I suppose you gave them all the details to build up the picture of me, eh,
yes,
Doctor?
As a matter of fact, I did, Holmes, and knowing some of your methods, we tried to plant every clue that you'd pick up.
Very neat job, too, and incidentally, a perfect example of the dangers of deductions based on purely circumstantial evidence. I shall profit from this little lesson.
I must say it was worth a fortune in emeralds to see your face, Holmes, when you realized what you'd done.
Well, the joke's over now. By the way, where is Lady Anne?
I believe she said she was going to fetch the Elphinstone emerald. She thought you might be interested in seeing it.
She probably feels the sight of it will salve my wounded vanity.
Oh, here she comes now.
Mr. Holmes! Mr. Holmes!
It's got... What's wrong?
What's happened, Lady Anne?
The emerald. It's not where I hid it. This time it's really stolen.
Well, Dr. Watson, your April Fool's Day plot kind of backfired on you, didn't it?
Yes, Mr. Bartell, it was a perfect example of the biter bit.
Well, what happened next? I suppose Sherlock Holmes went into action once again.
Mr. Bartell, it gladdened my heart to see the change in the Fuller. I confess I'd felt rather ashamed of my part in the prank, for I could see that Holmes's pride had been hurt. But now, with the definite crime before him, the difference was amazing. He suddenly became a dynamo, galvanized into action as he stood there, firing questions at the other members of the conspiracy.
Lady Anne, who beside yourself knew of this fresh hiding place?
Both Murphy and I did.
Yes. After we'd left our deliberate clues on the safe, we went with Lady Anne and saw her secrete the emerald in the top drawer of her dressing table.
We thought it would be all right there. After all, as soon as the joke was over, I was going to put it back in the safe.
Now, I think our wisest plan before we question the servants would be for each one of you who were in this April Fool's Day prank to submit to being searched.
Holmes, surely you don't suggest that any one of us took the emerald?
No, Stafford, I don't. But if any one of you four are not guilty, this will be a splendid way of proving your innocence.
I say, steady, Holmes. You're not suggesting that Lady Anne stole her own emeralds, are you?
Are you, Mr. Holmes?
I'm suggesting nothing, but I may point out that the recent vogue for, what should we say, you know, the insurance companies has provided another interesting motive for these so-called thefts.
I resent your insinuation. It's outrageous.
Lady Anne, if I'm to recover your emerald, I must at least consider every possibility. A search is the most immediate practical action. Perhaps you'll retire into the next room while I persuade these gentlemen to submit to being searched.
Very well, but I think you're in danger of making a fool of yourself once again.
No, wait, don't go, Lady Anne. A search won't be necessary.
What do you mean, Murphy?
I must throw myself on your mercy, Lady Anne. I confess that I stole the emerald.
Murphy!
After you put it in the drawer, Lady Anne, I slipped back into the room and took it out.
Murphy, that's a criminal action.
I know it, but I'm poor. I need money desperately for my mathematical research. I knew the emerald was priceless, and I couldn't resist the temptation to take advantage of a joke. Here, Lady Anne, here's the stone, and please don't prosecute me. Please don't. It'd be my ruin.
May I examine the emerald, Lady Anne? Thank you.
Well, Mr. Murphy, I won't pretend that I'm not deeply shocked. I must ask you to leave my house.
But you won't prosecute me, will you? It was a moment's temptation.
No, I won't prosecute you.
Holmes, what are you doing with the emerald?
Well, knowing something of the deceptive ways of thieves, I came on this case fully prepared to test the emerald when I found it. Now, a drop of this acid from this vial. So?
Mr. Holmes, what are you doing? You'll injure the stone.
Not if it's a true emerald. Uh-huh. Look at that.
Good Lord, the acid's eating to the stone as if it was sugar. But
then that means...
It means, Lady Anne, that Mr. Murphy has just imperiled his honor and his freedom to steal a singularly beautiful fake.
Mr. Holmes, this joke has turned into a nightmare. Is there no way of recovering my emerald?
I hope so, Lady Anne. I've been taking steps in their logical order. The servants have all been questioned. We've searched Mr. Stamford and Mr. Murphy.
Yes, most humiliating experience. Made me feel like a criminal.
Well, personally, I was only too thankful to submit to a search this time. I knew I had nothing to worry about.
You yourself, Lady Anne, you consented to being searched by the police matron that Holmes sent for?
Only because he threatened to send for the police if I didn't. But distasteful though it was, I'd rather endure that than have this story on the front pages of the newspapers.
And in spite of all these rather unfriendly proceedings, we've got exactly nowhere as regards finding the emerald.
No, Stamford, but we have at least eliminated the possibility that the thief is secreting the jewel on his person.
It's still somewhere in these two rooms, eh, Holmes?
I think so, though there is one remaining possibility.
And that is?
That the fake stone was substituted for the real emerald sometime before all of you engineered your April Fool's Day joke.
Oh, no, Mr. Holmes, that's not possible. I know it was the genuine emerald I took out of the safe this morning.
How can you be sure? The substitute was an excellent imitation. Without a chemical test such as I performed, it would be hard to be certain.
I can tell you why I'm certain. Last night, Papa came to dinner and brought a Mr. van der Leyde of Amsterdam. He examined the stone, and you'll agree that a jewel expert like that couldn't be fooled.
That's true, Lady Anne. And what did you do with the emerald after Mr. van der Leyde left?
I locked it in my safe and went to bed.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't unlock the safe again until Dr. Stamford and Mr. Murphy came here this morning.
That settles it, then. The real emerald is still hidden somewhere in these two rooms.
But where? That's the question.
I must say it's completely mystifying.
Well, let's go back to what we were all doing at the exact moment you came into the room, Lady Anne, and informed us of the loss of your stone. Now, we were...
We were drinking a toast to you.
That's
and...
That's it.
Lady Anne, hard thinking is, well, it's thirsty work.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Let me get you something. A glass of port, perhaps.
No, thank you. But I observe that you have a remarkably comprehensive assortment of liqueurs. I wonder if I might have a glass of Creme de Menthe.
Oh, of course. I'll get it for you.
Creme de Menthe in the middle of the day, Holmes.
I knew you were eccentric, but this really takes...
This bottle, it clinked as I picked it up.
I thought it might, Lady Anne.
There's something inside it.
Allow me, madam. Thank you. I'm sure you won't mind if I waste this liqueur on the aspidestra.
Oh, no, of course not.
So? Lady Anne? Allow me to restore to you the Elphinstone Emerald.
Great Scott.
Amazing.
Fantastic.
Ingenious. The one safe hiding place in the room. Where could a green gem be more effectively hidden than in a bottle of green liqueur?
But who stole it? Who substituted the fake stone?
Frankly, I don't care. The gem is restored. That's all that matters. I prefer not to go to court. Neither you nor I, Mr. Sherlock Holmes, would show up in the best of lights. And my father would disapprove of this whole affair, I'm afraid.
Just as you wish, Lady Anne. In either case, I shall expect your check for my services in due course.
Here we are at the Criterion again, Stamford. Won't you come in and join us for lunch?
Thanks, Watson, but I'll keep the cab and go on. I actually have a patient this afternoon. A rare and delightful experience for a young doctor, as you probably know.
As rare and delightful as a client is for a young detective, eh, Stamford?
Yes.
I quite understand, and I'm correspondingly grateful to you for your profitable hoax.
I'm glad it was profitable for you. Personally, I feel pretty stupid about the whole thing. Well, goodbye.
Goodbye, old fellow.
Goodbye.
39 Onslow Square, cabbie.
You're remarkably quiet, Mayford.
Well, I'm afraid my conscience won't let me do much talking, Doctor. I'm heartily ashamed of myself. Well, thanks for the lift. I'll leave you chaps
Oh, there. Nonsense, nonsense. You'll join us for lunch, Murphy.
But,
No buts about it. I insist. Come on.
Well, it's awfully nice of you.
Oh, come, Murphy. Any one of us can make a foolish mistake. It's just lucky that you didn't have to pay for yours.
Monsieur wishes it, David.
Yes, for three, please.
This way, monsieur. Does this table please you?
Excellent, thank you.
George, I'm as hungry as a hunter. How about you, Murphy?
No, I'm afraid I have very little appetite. This whole case has upset me dreadfully.
You mustn't take it so much to heart, Murphy. By the way, Doctor, I'd like to have your opinion on the case. Who do you think staged the theft of the emerald today?
Perfectly obvious to me. Lady Anne Parlington did it herself to collect the insurance money. If she hadn't, she'd have insisted on your finding the thief. But you needn't worry, old chap. You'll get your fee all right, I'm sure of that.
Oh, I'm not worrying about the fee. But I assure you, Lady Anne did not engineer that fraud today.
You mean that it was Stamford?
Tell him who was responsible, my dear Murphy.
But how should I know?
Oh, come now, Murphy. Let's not fence any longer. You did an excellent job, a superlative job. I was almost sorry to spoil it for you.
I don't think I understand you, Holmes.
Oh, yes, you do, Murphy. You're a splendid actor, too. I was so deeply touched when you had apparently stolen a fake jewel, and all the time you knew that the real one was safely hidden in the bottle of Creme de Menthe, to be abstracted at your leisure. Ha ha, you scoundrel.
Holmes, do you mind telling me what's going on here? I'm completely and absolutely in the dark.
Surely it's obvious, my dear Doctor. The imitation emerald was a brilliant copy.
What makes you so sure of that, my dear Holmes?
Because this April Fool's Day hoax was only conceived yesterday, or that is what you wish the others to believe. Such a superb paste gem could not have been made at such short notice. Therefore, it must have been prepared by someone who knew about the hoax before it was arranged. Now, my dear Doctor, when Stamford told you about the plan last night, whose idea did he say it was?
He told me that it was Lady Anne Partington's plan.
Precisely. And yet Lady Anne referred to it today as Stamford's idea. Obviously, you, my dear Murphy, presented the plan to each as the notion of the other, and so only you could have arranged the real theft behind the hoax. I repeat, a splendid job.
Thank you, Mr. Holmes. May I also compliment you on your cleverness in frustrating my plot?
Look here, what is all this? One of you is a criminal, the other a detective. Yet you're throwing each other compliments as if you were in the same profession.
The dividing line between the criminal and the criminal investigator is thinner than you might imagine, my dear doctor.
How very true, my dear Holmes. Would you consider coming over to my side of the line? Together we'd make an unbeatable team.
Oh, you flatter me. Nevertheless, I must decline your offer, Mr. Murphy.
Oh, a pity. On your side of the line, you'll never be a rich man. By the way, for your edification, my name is not Murphy. Though Stamford insists on thinking it is.
Then what is your name, you scoundrel?
Your friend says the word scoundrel so much better than you, Doctor. My name? My name is Murtry.
Oh, indeed. Spelled M-U-R-T-R-Y?
No. Dear me, I have so much trouble with my name. People will either misspell it or mispronounce it. I'm afraid I'll have to begin calling it the way it looks. M-O-R-I-A-R-T-Y. Moriarty.
Moriarty. I shall remember that name. I have a feeling we shall meet again.
I trust that we shall. You've won the first round, Sherlock Holmes, I admit that. But I believe that a return match is indicated.
I shall look forward to it, Moriarty. And now, Doctor, I can't stand your baleful glare any longer. Let's order lunch, shall we?
Doctor, that was a pretty hectic April Fool's Day.
Yes, it was. I never want to see another one exactly like it.
I don't blame you. You know, I'd sure hate to have someone come to my house and pull a trick like that on me.
Why, Mr. Bartell, do you have a precious emerald you fear may be stolen?
Are you kidding? I wouldn't know the difference between a precious emerald and a piece of green glass. But when it comes to rubies, now that's something else.
Oh, you would know a ruby when you saw it.
Sure. Because a ruby has exactly the same color as a glass of Petri California Port held up to the light.
Mr. Bartell, you can find more excuses for talking about Petri wine than any man in the entire world. Believe me.
Excuses, Doctor? I don't need an excuse to talk about Petri wine. Why, there's a wine that actually speaks for itself. If I may borrow a phrase from Shakespeare or somebody. There's no other wine quite like Petri wine because only Petri wine is made by the Petri family. And the Petri family has been making wine for generations. They've been handing down from father to son, years and years of knowledge and experience of the fine art of turning luscious grapes into clear, fragrant, delicious wine. Yes, and because the making of Petri wine is a family affair, those letters P-E-T-R-I on a bottle of wine are the personal assurance of the Petri family that every drop of wine in that bottle is good wine. You never miss with a Petri wine because Petri took time to bring you good wine. Well, Dr. Watson, what's the prescription for next week's
story? Well, next week, Mr. Bartell, I'm going to tell you a rather unusual story. It concerns a series of strange disappearances and a murder without apparent reason, and yet it was a case that Sherlock Holmes solved without ever meeting any of the suspects. I call it The Singular Affair of the Disappearing Scientists.
Well, I'm sure we'll all want to hear that one, Doctor.
Oh, I'm sure. Well, before you go, Mr. Bartell, I want to urge our friends to do all they can to save on the use of all wheat and rice products, and also fats and oils. There are millions of families literally starving to death in Europe and Asia. We're not being asked to give them our food. We're just being asked to take it easy on certain foods so that there will be some left for them to buy. I know there isn't one person listening to me tonight who would knowingly let anyone starve. And remember, unless you do help, thousands of little children will starve. So please, let's share a meal and save a life.
Tonight's Sherlock Holmes adventure was written by Dennis Green and Anthony Boucher and was suggested by an incident in Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's story, A Study in Scarlet. Music is by Dean Fossler. Mr. Rathbone appears through the courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and Mr. Bruce through the courtesy of Universal Pictures, where they are now starring in the Sherlock Holmes series. The Petri Wine Company of San Francisco, California, invites you to tune in again next week, same time, same station. Sherlock Holmes comes to you from our Hollywood studios. This is Harry Bartell saying goodnight for the Petri family. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
And that's The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes from April 1st, 1946, with the April Fool's Day Adventure starring Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce. Hope you enjoyed that. All right, we've all been waiting for the conclusion, Chapter 5, of this five-part adventure called The Lamar Matter on yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Let's go back to March 30th, 1956. Here is Bob Bailey in yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
From Hollywood, it's time now for...
Johnny Dollar.
This is Larry Comstock, Johnny, at Tri-Mutual Insurance. You're out at the Lamar home.
Yeah, Larry. Police crime lab, find out anything more about the stuff from here they took in for examination?
Yes. Yes, they certainly did.
Well?
They found traces of that poison, pyrodameron, on the toothbrush that Thomas Lamar was using just before he
on
died.
Are you kidding?
Oh, no. No, indeed, John. Not a bit.
There's a murder weapon for you, a toothbrush. Larry, send the cops out here. I think I've just about got this case sewed up.
Tonight and every weekday night, Bob Bailey in the transcribed adventures of the man with the action-packed expense account, America's fabulous freelance insurance investigator...
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar. Expense account submitted by Special Investigator Johnny Dollar, location South Bend, Indiana, to the Universal Adjustment Bureau, Hartford, Connecticut. The following is my final entry of expenses incurred during investigation of the Lamar murder. And murder it most certainly was. It was in La Jolla, California, during my so-called vacation, that I met, and I must admit, kind of fell for Vonnie Lamar. It was from La Jolla that I flew her back to South Bend, Indiana, when we both received news of her foster father's sudden death. All the clues I'd been able to dig up seemed to point to one Walter Marson, who had been Lamar's personal secretary and who lived at the Lamar mansion. At his room there in the house, I found the one book in the world that described the poison, pyrodameron, that had killed Thomas René Lamar. Poison derived from a pretty little yellow flower once raised on an island near Greece. The flower was sudden death in its pollen. Huh?
You're Johnny Dollar, aren't you? Harrison the butler said you were up here.
And you must be Walter Marson.
What are you doing in my room?
Let me ask the questions, Marson.
Now, just a minute.
Look, mister, you may as well know it. I'm an insurance investigator.
So Harrison said, but I don't believe it.
Right here, my credentials.
Uh-huh. Oh, I see, but I thought...
You thought I was just a boyfriend that Vonnie Lamar met in La Jolla and who just came back here with her to comfort her over the loss of her father.
Yes, that's right.
Well, you were wrong, mister, or partly so. The main reason I'm here is to find out who murdered Thomas Lamar and why. And I think I found out.
You have? Well, who, Mr. Dollar?
Interesting book you've been reading here.
Oh.
Flora Exotica Mediterranea. Stolen from the Central Library over in Chicago, wasn't it?
Well, yes. Yes, it was.
Found a poison in it, didn't you, Marson? Pyrodameron. Deadly, quick, and hard to trace. So rare that the chances were pretty good it wouldn't even be recognized. But it was. Where'd you get it, Walter?
As you said, at the library.
I'm talking about the poison, the pyrodameron that killed Thomas Lamar.
Oh, no. You're all wrong.
Am I? Who besides Vonnie would benefit from the million and a half insurance on Lamar's life?
Well, what makes you think that
I know
that
you
I'd
would,
be the...
because I know you're married to Vonnie.
Oh, no.
You tried to inveigle your way into Lamar's business, but he wouldn't have it. All your chiseling and conniving and phony stock transactions got you nowhere. So you did the next thing you could think of. You got something on Vonnie and forced her to marry you. So you thought you'd at least be sure of a big hunk of the insurance money over my dead
oh,
body.
Oh, no, look, Dollar, maybe I was married to Bonnie, but...
I found out about her big gambling debts, got her off the hook by some fancy manipulation of her foster father's investments. No doubt threatened to tell him all about it unless she did marry you. and thereby guaranteed yourself a prosperous future. Oh, and you timed the whole thing beautifully when she was emotionally upset over the death of Mrs. Lamar.
No, Dolly, you don't know what you're talking about.
Couldn't wait for him to die a natural death.
Dolly. Mr. Dolly.
Sure, go ahead, speak up and make it good.
Well, I was married to Vonnie. But I'm not now.
Sure.
That's right. I did want a place in Lamar Metal Products, and I thought I could get it by showing Mr. Lamar how clever I was. Well, instead of throwing me out, he gave me another chance. I'll be forever grateful to him. It was a turning point in my life. I give you my word, Mr. Dollar, I've done nothing since that time that's been anything but completely honest and above board.
Pretty speech.
No, it's true. It's true, I swear it.
Nevertheless, you married Vonnie in the hope
We're divorced.
You're what?
Well, it was the only honorable thing I could do. Would you like to see the final papers? Vonnie mailed them to me from Reno before she went to La Jolla.
You mean she... Yeah, let me see them.
Here. My desk.
Don't try to pull a gun out of there, Marcel.
You still don't believe me, do you? Here they are.
Then would you like to tell me who did murder Thomas Lamar?
I wish to heaven I knew. That's why I got this book, hoping to find some clue as to where the pirate Dameron might have come from.
But you sneaked this book out of the library.
Because I was afraid of the very kind of suspicion that you've shown.
Want to know something? I'm still showing.
And I tell you you're wrong. Ask Vonnie. She'll tell you.
Oh, where is she? Harrison said you two had gone out together to make arrangements for the funeral.
Yes, we did, and we came back together. But when Harrison told her that you were here to see her, she said she'd be back in a few minutes.
Where did she go?
Oh, she's still in the house somewhere, I think.
Marson, just what is your relationship with Vonnie now?
Well, there never was any love between us. Our marriage was only on paper.
Yeah?
The foster daughter of the man to whom I owe so much, it's my duty to do what I can for her. In spite of her...
Remember what?
Oh, even to the end, we kept from him any knowledge of her dissipations, her drinking and gambling.
I thought that was all over.
Oh, no, she's more deeply in debt now than she's ever been. I'm thankful Mr. Lamar died without knowing.
Well, I'll be.
But with the insurance, of course, you'll be able to pay off.
Marson, you're a dirty rat, and your accusation isn't very well veiled.
Are you trying to say that I'm accusing Vonnie of the... murder? Oh. Mr. Dollar.
Yeah, go on.
This book. According to this, the plant from which Pirate Dameron is derived is now extinct.
Unless somebody, somewhere, managed to salvage some seeds that were then planted.
Yes, exactly. Well, for a purpose, Kellendus, found only on a small Grecian island, I wonder if Dimitri would know about...
Dimitri? What's this sudden switch? Who's Dimitri?
He's the old gardener. He's here on the estate.
Come on, Marson, and bring that book. Before going out to the gardener's cottage, I asked Harrison where Vonnie had gone, and he told us he only knew that she was somewhere in the grounds, that her car was still in the driveway. I phoned Larry Comstock again, but he'd left his office, presumably to come out here. And I called the man I'd talked to earlier at the library.
Oh, of course I can. As I told you before, I keep a very close check on the books in that section. Let me see now.
Yeah?
Yes, Flora Exotica Mediterranea has only been out four or five times in the past several years. Once to a Mr. Thomas...
Yeah?
Thomas Hanley.
Oh.
To a Mr. Ralph Cummings, Miss Levon Lamar, and...
That's enough. Thanks. I tried not to show Marson how I felt as we walked out to the cottage of Dimitri, the old gardener.
Could be nothing too nice for Mr. Lamar. So I always try keep things nice.
Yeah, I can see.
Dimitri, Mr. Dollar's here to investigate the circumstances of Mr. Lamar's death.
Oh, yes. I hope you find who do this terrible thing to such a fine...
Well, I want you to look at this book. Here. Did you ever see a flower like that?
Oh, yes.
Yes, where?
In old country. In Greece it used to be, but no more.
You never saw it in this country?
No, yes.
Well, which is it?
Uh, You should not say, because in all countries, against the law. I don't know why.
Well, I do. Go on, Dimitri.
But I keep many of my nice seeds anyway.
And some of them were for this flower?
Yes. You don't mind? It is very pretty flower.
Did you ever plant any of them?
Oh, no, not I.
Somebody else?
She was always so nice to me.
Bonnie, Miss Lamar.
Look, sir, she even sent me gift on her trip last week.
Dimitri.
Look, you call it toilet case. See? It have soap and toothbrush and comb.
Dollar, look, that toothbrush.
I am looking. The yellow stain on the bristles, the same color as the flower on this deadly plant.
So pretty.
She sent her father one of these to her. Oh, Dollar, I'm sick.
You sick, poor
so
man?
So crude, so corny, and so obvious it would never be noticed. And she was safely a couple of thousand miles away beyond any possible suspicion when the... Dimitri, did she plant any of these seeds you gave her?
She often plant many kinds.
Where? Show us.
In the morning, maybe. It's getting pretty dark now.
Now, come on. Come on, Marson.
Yeah. You must not tell her, I show you. She always keep her little garden secret. She not even think I know. She very sweet girl.
Yeah, very. But now...
Wait. Huh? She there now. Cultivating.
Cultivating? With a shovel? Dimitri, go back to your cottage and stay there.
Oh, you want...
Come on, Marson.
She's digging. Digging.
And I think I know why.
She sees us.
Go back. Go away, both of you.
Stay here. I want to talk to you, Vonnie. What are you doing?
What I'm doing is... I'm burying the little garden that was mine for Daddy. Little personal things, Johnny, that I grew with my own hands for him alone. Now that he's gone, this would be only one more bit of memory. Please, leave me, Johnny, to finish.
Wait, Bonnie.
What?
Before you turn under that little yellow flower. Here, I'll show you.
No, Johnny, don't touch it.
Here. Source of a poison called pyrodamerin.
How did you know?
Here, look.
Oh, no, you don't. I'll kill you, too. I'll kill you.
Oh, nobody, no.
Oh, Walter, help me.
Help you.
No. Johnny was in love with me, but I turned him down, and he came out here.
No good, Bonnie.
I hate you. I hate you both. Everything would have been all right if you hadn't come along. I hate you. Listen, Johnny. $1 million. 1.5 million. You and I could...
Oh, you dirty...
No, Johnny, please, don't! Please!
Believe me, this is one case I wish I'd never seen. Oh, sure, you, the company, are all right. You won't have to pay off $1.5 million in insurance. Your gain. But me, I've lost something. Faith. Faith in... I'm sick over the whole thing. Expense account, I'll add it up later. Right now, I'm going out and get some flowers. Some clean flowers. And just sit and look at them. Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Now here's our star to tell you about next week's exciting story.
Next week, tell me, did you ever wake up from a pleasant dream to find a smoking gun in your hand and two bodies at your feet? Well, I have. Join us next week, and I'll tell you about it. Yours truly, Johnny Dollar.
Yours truly, Johnny Dollar, starring Bob Bailey, is transcribed in Hollywood. It is produced and directed by Jack Johnstone, who also wrote this week's story. Heard in the cast were Virginia Gregg, Lawrence Dobkin, Harry Bartell, Eric Snowden, Howard McNair, John Daner, Gene Tatum, Joseph Kearns, Paul Richards, and Jack Moyles. Musical supervision by Amerigo Marino. Be sure to join us on Monday night, same time and station, for another exciting story of yours truly, Johnny Dollar, Roy Rowan speaking.
That's yours truly, Johnny Dollar, from March 30th, 1956. The Lamar Matter, Part 5, starring Bob Bailey.
Please salute our brave men and women fighting overseas for their support of the USA. This salute courtesy of a concerned citizen, John Wadzita, serving the U.S. Postal Service for over 38 years. John Wadzita is on the air saluting our troops.
More of the WGN Radio Theater after these words. Well, what's on the agenda for next week,
Well,
Lisa?
Great shows, of course. We've got Broadway Is My Beat, Red Rider, The Shadow, The Adventures of Philip Marlowe, Fibber McGee and Molly, and we've got another five-part Yours Truly, Johnny Dollar story.
Well, everybody likes Johnny Dollar, so I thought we'd play more, right?
Yeah, it's kind of great the way we kind of keep you in suspense for five full hours
here. All right, well, we'll be back here next Saturday at 10 p.m.